Hello, everybody. We are live. Let me toot about it. I'm still not used to toot. After this whole, like, you know, we all kind of fled what was formerly known, the arms formerly known as Twitter, about a year ago, and, you know, fled to Mastodon mostly, and then Blue Sky, and then Threads, and I don't really know, like, where this is all going to end up. I think the answer is probably going to be a mix of a whole bunch of things, but mostly Mastodon and Threads. But still, now, like, 1 year into kind of living on Mastodon, still not used to toot.
I'm used to it. I like it.
I don't know. I flip back and forth. I still use toot periodically because I just think it's funny. But yeah, I flip back and forth. And anyone who is not a nerd and at least passably familiar with Mastodon, I usually just call it a tweet. Any sort of I almost said long form, any sort of short form microblog sort of thing, sorry man, I typically just refer to as a tweet because that at least is understood.
That's what I like about toot, is that it's kind of a signal to other people who are in the know, who know what the hell you're talking about. If someone knows what you mean when they say toot, they probably are also on Mastodon. And people who don't just think you mispronounced tweet or something. The problem is things like Threads and Blue Sky, where they just call everything posts. I know there was a bunch of weird slang terms for Blue Sky posts for a while, skeets and stuff like that, but or I don't know, maybe I'm misremembering it. But anyway, I don't think there's any marketing term for Threads specifically. And I think people just call them posts.
I guess. Yeah. I mean,
maybe, you know, they're not going to say you posted a thread. I don't know. Post is the catch-all. You can have blog posts. You could post on Twitter. You can post on Mastodon. Posting is posting.
That's fair. All right. Do we want to talk about some gift memberships, John? Do you want me to do the pitch? Do you want to do the pitch? How do you want to handle this? Good talk.
I have a moment of pause because I could do it, but I kind of want to hear what you would do just as a form of entertainment.
All right. Oh my God. Here we go, kids. Buckle up. It's time to talk gift membership. So our friend, my friend and yours, John Syracusa, my best, worst friend, worst, best friend. I always get it wrong. I'm sorry, Merlin.
You got it wrong twice. So there you go.
Wait, what's the right one then?
Worst friend. It's like best friend, but the word best has been replaced with worst.
I thought.
Humor value.
No, because that's semi-aggressively negative, and I thought
it is. I didn't make it up.
This is the Casey version. The Casey version is recalling, trying to make a reference to another show, but making it nicer.
Right, exactly. Right.
Okay. A little more friendly version.
We're chalking up to niceness and not poor memory.
/ ineptitude. So yeah, my worst, best, best, worst friend, John Syracusa, copyright 2023 Casey list. Anyways, he has put in a genuinely large amount of work, and I put in a slightly more than zero amount of work in making gift memberships a thing on our website and our membership, you know, system. So if you have a nerd in your life that probably is listening to this, I don't know how this is going to work, but hey, if you have a nerd in your life that might be interested in our plucky little Apple related show, and maybe they're a little bit too frugal, or as I would call myself, cheap, to pay for a membership, you can pay for a month or even a year of membership. You can go to atp.fm/gift. You can gift this person a membership. Now, we never, ever, ever tell them that they've been gifted a membership. That is on you, in part because we're lazy and didn't have the time to do it, but mostly because we wanted you to be in control of how you message that whole thing. You can print something out. You can just send them an email. You can drop a random link in an iMessage conversation. I wouldn't recommend using Beeper, but you know, you can give it a shot. But nevertheless, one way or another, you can go to atp.fm/gift to gift someone a membership. Now, a couple of quick points of order. You need to create an account with us that is free for reasons. In order to gift a membership, you can immediately delete that account afterwards if you so desire, or you could sign up for yourself. You can stack gift memberships because John did not do the bare minimum of work. You can stack them. So if you are lucky enough to receive several gift memberships, they will stack such that when one runs out, the next one will begin. And you may not have to pay for a long time, which would be super fun. But yeah, atp.fm/gift. It is all right there. John has written an FAQ for you to read. There's all sorts of wonderful and fun stuff that you can check out, atp.fm/gift. The time is running out. We are recording this. I believe it's the 18th. I don't even know. I'm all over the place. Yes, it's Monday the 18th as we record this. These gifts are ready instantly. So you could be, if you are the kind to celebrate Christmas, you could be doing this on Christmas morning if necessary. And, you know, write a very unusual URL on a piece of paper, put it in an envelope and say, hey, Merry Christmas to you. So go check out hp.fm/gift. John, anything to add?
That was everything I dreamed it would be, Casey.
I'm so happy for us.
Classic Yay Casey us. List promotion. Yes. Yeah. The only thing I would add is the way it works is if you're listening to this and you want a gift membership, just text somebody who you think is going to give it to you and say, hey, if you're looking for something to get me for the holidays, atp.fm/gift. You have to deliver the URL to them and then they buy it for you. That's how the system works. They're not going to be listening to the show. How would they ever listen to the show? They don't know about the show. All they need to know is that this is a fun gift that you would like. You, who's listening now, give somebody else the URL. They'll get the hint.
This is and the equivalent of like, you know, leaving the catalog open on the table with the thing you want circled and dog-eared.
Yes. Exactly.
And this, I got to say, like, you know, as somebody who I listen to a lot of podcasts for which I am paying members or Patreon supporters or whatever. And so I have a lot of podcasts where I have gone like from the regular version to the member version, usually with the benefit of some kind of exclusive content and ad freeness. And that is one of the it is a great gift to give somebody, because taking something that you're already doing in your life and making it a bit nicer is a fantastic gift, especially if it's the kind of thing that, like, the person probably would not have spent the money on it themselves for whatever reason, but you can make this thing nicer for them. Like, that is always the best kind of gift. Like, you buy somebody, like, a really good tool for some hobby they're doing, or you, like, you know, upgrade something for them that, you know, they would really appreciate that they wouldn't necessarily spend the money on, or, you know, or something like that. That's like, the category of great gifts, in my opinion, and this is exactly in that category. Like, if for someone who likes this show, if they're on a member and you buy them membership, like, that just makes the show better for them. So it's a wonderful thing. Whenever there's a podcast that I listen to that has a paid version, I almost always get it, and I'm always happier with it, because I honestly don't, you know, like having to skip ads if I don't have to. I'd rather just have them not be there, and any kind of bonus stuff that comes along with it is very helpful.
Indeed. atp.fm/gift. Give a gift to you, to your friend, to your loved one, and by doing it through us, you're giving a gift to us too. So, hey, thanks. But anyways, yeah, check it out, and we appreciate it. Let's do some follow-up. We have a handful of people that have written in with regard to an Ask ATP last week about Apple devices and OLED burn-in. We start with David Giancursio. I hope I got that right. I actually did have burn-in issues on my iPhone XS. I had it plugged in and on a stand at work, using it as an always-on display before that was a feature. In fuzzy versions of the battery, Wi-Fi strength, and clock became permanent fixtures on my screen. This is, I think, effectively nightmare fuel for John Siracusa.
Yeah, and, that's just how burn-in works. And by the way, the reason they were fuzzy, we didn't mention this last week, but in the long list of burn-in mitigation techniques that OLED screens use, or something that I believe plasma screens also use, which is like they shift the image a little bit from side to side, so it's not always on at the same place. I don't know if the XS did this, but I believe the current ones do it as well. So I always question the value of that feature. And by the way, modern TVs, in case you're worried that you're going to be losing parts of the picture, which you did back in the bad old days of plasma, modern TVs over-provision the pixels. So even when they pixel shift it, you aren't losing any pixels. They're just shifting the image around not lighting up some pixels on one side.
TVs. So the physical panel is actually larger than the picture by a little bit.
By a little bit, yeah. Because it used to be in the plasma days, like you do that, you know, they have these various calibration tests where it'll show you like this, you should be able to see this rectangle, and it would put a thin rectangle around the whole screen, right? And you'd know if you had like the overscan thing on, you'd be like, oh, I can't see the rectangle, it's screwed up, so you fix the overscan feature. But the pixel shift or pixel orbiter thing, it would cut off one of the borders. But then when it shifted to like the left, you wouldn't see the left border anymore, because it would be like a one pixel line, it would be shifted off the edge. Now I believe all the good OLED TVs have enough pixels to move it around. I think they do that on like computer monitors. I don't know if the iPhone does it. It's a very difficult thing to find out, because they tend not to list it. They will list the pixel shift feature under some branded name, but they won't always say, oh, and also we over-provisioned by 7 pixels on all edges to handle this. Pixels are so small now on retina displays, it's hard to tell, but on TVs, I think you can actually see this if you look up real close.
Yeah, and I think it's important to point out too, like, you know, this instance of burn-in on a XS, as David said, who wrote it in, like, this was kind of creating an always-on situation. Had it plugged in and on a stand at work, using it as an always-on display before there was a feature. So what this means is, you know, because with the iPhone, you can tell it to never sleep the screen. Like, that's a setting you can have access to. And if you just, like, leave it plugged in, never sleeping the screen, any phone can be left on all the time. I don't recommend this for lots of reasons, but this is, again, this is what happened here. And so this kind of shows, like, you know, like when Always On came out as a feature with the 14 Pro, was it 14 Pro? Anyway, when it came out as a feature, and some people were like, wait, why can't they have this, like, added via software to the older models? One of the reasons, the answer is they might have been able to, but, and market segmentation is important for their most profitable product, but one of the technical reasons why they might not have wanted to do that or might not be, have been able to do that is because they knew when launching the 14 Pro, they knew this was going to be a feature of it, and so they were able to make decisions with, like, what specs the OLED panel had, what kind of OLED it was, how it was going to be driven, within what range it was going to be driven. And they were able to launch this feature knowing what the hardware was going to be for it, slash pick the hardware knowing that this feature was going to be important for them, so that they could have a panel that could, you know, get more use this way without having burn-in become a problem. Whereas on the older phones, that wasn't necessarily possible, or that wasn't necessarily like a trade-off that they made with those component selections. And so as time goes on, like, you know, components change, types of OLEDs change, and different ones have different tolerances for this. So, you know, the modern ones where they actually launched this feature, you know, in mind with these hardware panels, can usually take it a lot better.
Oh, and getting back to my point about the pixel orbiting and my doubt about the feature, like, imagine you've got a rectangle that's your little battery. Pretend that it's always full. It's just a white rectangle. Orbiting it by a few pixels, like shifting it over and up and left and right by a few pixels, all that's going to do is make a slightly less burned-in halo around the burned-in rectangle, right? Like, you're not actually stopping burn-in. You're just trying to spread it around by a tiny little bit. So I've never been a fan of that feature. I'm like, I don't think this helps me. Like, having a fuzzy burned-in rectangle for my battery instead of a crisp one, it's the rectangle is still there. But, you know, that people do what they can.
Jameson Weiss writes, I am currently using an iPhone 14 Pro that shows no signs of burn-in, but my previous phone, an iPhone 11 Pro, did show noticeable burn-in around the menu bar icons. I could very faintly but noticeably see the ghost of the battery icon and the clock in the Wi-Fi symbol. Keith writes, my Apple Watch Series 5 and iPhone 13 Pro Max both have OLED burn-in. The watch has the complications burned in and the phone has the status bar burned in. So it's apparently on the watch as well. And then an anonymous person writes, Apple Store technicians have a diagnostic that will check and tell us if the device has developed a display profile. The display profile helps mitigate, through software, OLED burn-in. When we do repairs such as rear system or mid-system replacement, we must run an additional diagnostic during repair. This test involves connecting the customer's original rear or mid-system and the repaired device to a Mac, which then allows us to transfer the display profile. We do these steps because the display itself does not have the components to store the display profile. It is instead stored on the main logic board. When this display profile test was first introduced, we originally had to replace the whole device when it was flagged because we did not have the tools to perform the display profile transfer. But now we perform this repair daily. I personally have seen a display show burn-in before performing this display profile transfer diagnostic. Anecdotally, always-on display has not led to an increase in these display profile transfers that I've noticed. Further instances of noticeable burn-in have also been very rare.
This is what I was talking about last week with burn-in mitigation. Basically, if you don't drive every single pixel on the display to the maximum amount, you have a little bit of headroom. So if the displays get worn out and they're a little bit more dim, the display can compensate by sending essentially more electricity to that pixel to make it the same brightness as its neighbors. Televisions do this through a series of sort of, they have branded names for everything in televisions, but like they do these cycles when the display is turned off. I'm not quite sure how, but they do. But when your television is turned off, if you have a modern OLED television, at some regular interval, it does some test to essentially recalibrate itself to make sure all the pixels are the same brightness, every single individual subpixel, right? So if you've worn out the red one particular red subpixel is not as bright as its neighbor, they can figure that out somehow, and they will give that red subpixel a little bit more electricity than its neighbor, basically trying to even it out. The rthings.com burn-in test that they've been running for years, actually ran into this recently because the test that they were doing didn't allow certain brands to run their sort of display update cycle thing, because like they all cycle based on like, oh, you have to be idle for this amount of time or whatever. And they were just running the the screen's just, you know, 24 hours a day or something close to it. So it never got to run the compensation cycle. So it looked like the burn-in was awful. But then once they figured that out, once they figured out how to detect when it's running the cycle, they let it run its cycle and it was a dramatic difference. And so what this Apple Store technician is telling us is basically that, but for iPhones, that the iPhone also can figure out, oh, you've worn out these pixels and now we need to drive them a little bit harder. And that display profile, I imagine, is like a big map of like, hey, for every single subpixel on the display, does it need a little bit more juice than its neighbors and how much more? And the fact that they used to just chuck the whole phone or eventually recycle it or whatever, because they couldn't just transfer the profile, which is just, it's just data, right? It's just, they couldn't transfer. It's like, well, you know, we have to give you an all new phone because there's no way I can transfer this stuff. It's good that they've introduced the ability to transfer it. But yeah, that's part of how you make OLEDs, quote unquote, not burn in. You're still wearing out the pixels as every time. It's like vinyl, Casey. Every time you use it, you're wearing it out a little bit. Using it is wearing it out. There is no way to use it without wearing it out. Every time your screen is on, you are degrading the organic compounds in those OLED pixels. But if you weren't driving them at the maximum amount, you've got a little bit of headroom and the display can figure it out and compensate for it.
All right, let's talk stolen device protection in the 17.3 beta. Russell Quinn writes, trusted locations is kind of, let me get some context here. I'm sorry. So one of the things that they've said is you have an hour delay when you go to do certain operations, like, you know, changing your Apple ID password, except if you're at a trusted location, which is allegedly like work and home. So Russell Quinn writes, trusted locations is kind of flawed because most people will have those very addresses, home and work, in their contacts app right there in the My Card at the top. If your phone is swiped in a bar, et cetera, there's a reasonable chance that you're not that far from home. Russell is implying then that, you know, the thief could go drive or train or what have you to your house or your work as quickly as possible. And hopefully for them, change your Apple ID password before you have the chance to lock all of this using iCloud on another device. So yeah,
we didn't have this in here, but there was some other feedback from, I guess, someone who's used the beta that these locations, these trusted location things, are configurable. It's not like it demands to be home and work and it just pulls them from your address book or something. And I think there either is some kind of lock on those locations, or maybe the person was saying there should be. Lock meaning like if someone gets your phone that they can't see or change those locations or whatever, but I'm not quite sure how that'd be possible once they have your phone and your passcode, but we'll see how this works out. But the people who are very paranoid, I assume what you can do is just say there are no trusted locations. I always have to wait an hour. So then you eliminate this whole issue. But it's asking people to make the security and convenience trade-off is always dangerous because they'll always pick convenience, right? You kind of... If you don't sort of default them to having like at least their home be a safe location, they're not going to like add it themselves. They're like, why would I make my life more difficult? Or they wouldn't, you know, maybe someone would convince them to do it, but the first time they had to wait an hour, they would get rid of it as soon as possible. So, you know, interested to see how this shakes out when they actually ship this feature and what the actual effect is based on the defaults they choose.
Richard Harris also made an interesting point. You described a scenario where if my phone and its passcode have been stolen while I am out, but I have enabled stolen device protection, I can use someone else's web browser within an hour to log into iCloud.com and find or wipe my phone. However, with two-factor on in my iCloud account, I cannot log into iCloud.com from an untrusted browser without also entering the 6 digits that are sent to my trusted device, which in this case was just stolen. Since most people should have two-factor enabled on their iCloud account and most people do not leave the house carrying their iPad or laptop, even if they have such devices, how does the new stolen device protection feature help in the most frequently cited scenarios? I don't have a good answer for this other than, you know, if you have, you know, like say 1Password or something like that, you could potentially log into your 1Password account on the web. However, that also requires a very, very large GUID looking thing, which I certainly do not have memorized and would also be stored in, you know, a 1Password on a trusted device, which it presumably has just been stolen. So I don't have a good answer for this.
Well, that's not going to give you the Apple two-factor pop-up though either.
That's why we were talking about whether 1 hour is the right amount of time, because there are solutions to this. Okay. So obviously if you're within an hour of your house and you can get back to your house, and if you're like us and have more than one Apple device, like you don't need your phone. You can use a Mac that is a trusted device or, you know, other ways to get into it. Also, there are backup codes. I don't know if a backup code will be sufficient on its own because I haven't actually tried this, but it is a thing that exists where you can get backup codes to sort of recover if all else fails. and you should have those printed out and stored in a physically secure location that hopefully you can get to within an hour. And then the final thing is, you know, again, if you can actually get home, you can sign in from one of your Macs that is already able to sign into iCloud without going through the two-factor stuff, because it's always signed in, because, you know. Yeah, so I'm interested to see how Apple pitches this. The idea is that if your phone is stolen and you have that hour timer starts, hopefully you can do something within that hour to get yourself in. Obviously, you can't do anything if you don't have a phone and you're alone. You have to find somebody else who's going to let you use their web browser or whatever. But if they do, depending on how nerdy you are, there are various scenarios you can imagine, like, you know, using some sort of web VPN interface to get into your house and remotely control a computer that's already signed into your iCloud account, yada, yada, yada. Backup code seems like the most regular person friendly, but even that stuff, like, what you do is you'd have those codes printed out. You'd have them in your wallet somewhere. You would not label them. That's a little security tip. Don't say, these are my Apple ID backup codes. Just put them on a piece of paper. You know what they are. Bury them in some pocket of your wallet that you don't frequently use. Make sure it's waterproof and the ink is not going to smear or whatever. And then worst case scenario, you can, you know, find a browser and log in. And again, I don't know if the backup code all by itself is sufficient. It might also require a two-factor. So that's, you know, 1 hour is what I think the time is in 17.3 beta. Having that time be configurable might be interesting for people who care. But again, when you ask people to choose between security and convenience, maybe things don't come out the way you want. So we'll see how it goes. Again, this is beta, hasn't yet shipped.
All right. Mathos Woolard writes, one thing to note in the EU's removable battery legislation is that they explicitly carve out exceptions for devices that have a high level of water resistance. So maybe batteries don't have to be so easily removable? Question mark.
Yeah, I don't think any of this stuff is finalized. I do wonder if Apple isn't currently at that high level of resistance, if they wouldn't make sure they're at the water resistance just so they don't have to do the battery thing. Again, we'll see what actually comes out of this as a law or guideline or whatever when they're done.
Skeen Harshly writes, that is a great name, my word. It is absolutely correct, or I'm sorry, John Syracuse is absolutely correct about Vext, and the best part is someone ported it to iOS as Vext Plus. This was John's beloved Palm OS game, and apparently you can get it on your iOS device, so that's cool.
I immediately snagged that, although one thing I noticed, this is the part of any kind of retro type gaming thing. I got it on my iPhone. I'm like, hey, it's the same levels I remember. And it looks a little different because it's on your iPhone or whatever. And then I realized, oh, it feels totally different when I'm swiping the blocks with my finger than using a stylus. And I know that sounds dumb, right? But it's just like, what is my memory of playing Vext? Apparently, a big part of my memory of playing Vext is pushing little blocks with a stylus.
Sorry.
I mean, I got to say, like, having playing with my Palm Pilot, like having, you know, played Hearts and stuff on it now and my meal.
Not a Palm
game,
Pilot.
Whatever. My Palm OS device that was
on my Nintendo.
It was released after the Pilot 1000 and Pilot 5000 models, but not that much after. Anyway, so a big part of the feel of what, like, you know, what gives me the nostalgia and the feel of it is the feel of having that stylus and tapping those little things on the screen. It's something that we don't have anymore, really. Like, you know, you kind of have it with the Apple Pencil on the iPad, but not really. Like, it's
screen doesn't squish.
Yeah, it's a very different feeling. And what we have now is generally better for almost every way. Like, it's generally much better now. And I'm not saying we should go back to this. And if you try an old resistive, you know, squish screen like this, you will almost certainly think it's worse. But it is different. And so if you play these same games on a touchscreen or with a mouse, they are different and it doesn't feel the same. So if what you're looking for is the nostalgia of how it used to feel to use Palm OS device, not a Palm Pilot, John. if you're looking for that feel, you're not going to get it right with like any kind of emulation with a touchscreen or a mouse pointer.
And it was kind of, you know, so the idea of direct manipulation, I've talked about this in many past shows, but like moving a block in Vext, basically you have these little blocks and they're actually very small on the screen. They're much smaller than they would be like to be good touch targets. Moving that block with the stylus on a Palm device feels like direct manipulation. You feel like, especially since the screen squishes, you feel like you're shoving the block off because there's gravity on the screen. So if you shove the block off of another block, it just falls down, right? You feel like you're directly manipulating the block with your little prod, right? When you play on the the iOS version, which is a faithful port, first of all, your finger entirely covers the block and maybe a little bit of some of its neighbors, because the blocks are, again, not, they're not 44 points. They're much smaller than that, right? You can't really see what you're doing. And when you slide with your finger, yeah, it pushes the block over. But by the time you lift your finger up so you can see the screen again, the block has already basically fallen. It doesn't feel like you're directly manipulating. It feels almost like you're swiping on the screen in the vague area of the block, and then a block goes down. It is much less satisfying. But I would still say, I mean, no one's going to get buy a Palm on eBay so they can play this game. So definitely check out the game. I think it's free. I don't know. I buy iOS apps without thinking about it. It's either free or extremely cheap. But check it out, because it is a fun puzzle game. It is very much like every puzzle game you've ever seen. Like, oh, it's a little bit like Tetris, a little bit like Bejeweled, a little bit like this, but it's not exactly like any of them. And the levels are very clever, and they do a good job of teaching you the mechanics. You should check it out and go through the first 10 levels or something. Have some fun.
By the way, I tried installing it on my Palm 5X and it crashed. So I'll have to figure out, maybe I had like the wrong version, or maybe I had like, I think I might have had too new of a version, because, you know, what with the Palm devices, like, you went from these super simple 160 by 160 monochrome and then grayscale screens. Over the following years, you went to higher resolution screens, much faster processors, color screens, and various different OS and networking upgrades and stuff like that. And so a lot of the like kind of high-end Palm OS games were really made for those later systems, and they don't necessarily work on my Palm 5X running OS, whatever it is. So I got to maybe find an old version.
Let's talk about Apple's required reasons thing for certain APIs. This blew up, I want to say, 2-3 months ago. They decided that for certain APIs, a lot of which I think made sense, but some of which, particularly user defaults, was quite surprising. User defaults is the thing that most app developers use to store like preferences for their app or apps and things of that nature. And they were saying, you know, it was very, very scary what Apple was not really threatening, but saying they were going to do that, you know, oh, you're going to have to provide reasons for using user defaults, and it's going to be big and scary. And since every freaking app uses user defaults, it seemed a bit silly. So apparently Apple's updated its required reasons thing for using certain APIs, and user defaults has new reasons. It has three of them with very odd code names. The first one, declare this reason to, or I guess this is why you would use it, declare this reason to access user defaults to read and write information that is only accessible to the apps, app extensions, and app clips that are members of the same app group as the app itself. So in other words, stuff that you write that only you and your apps can touch. The next one, declare this reason if your third-party SDK is providing a wrapper function around the user defaults APIs for the app to use, and you only access user defaults APIs when the app calls your wrapper function. This reason may only be declared by third-party SDKs. This reason may not be declared if your third-party SDK was created primarily to wrap the required reason APIs. So jump in, fellas, if I've got this wrong, but I guess if I were to vend a framework or a facade in front of user defaults, then I could claim this to explain why I'm using user defaults. Is that about what this sounds like to you?
No, I believe it's saying you can't claim this. So the way I interpret this is, if you make an API that happens to, or if you make a library that happens to allow user defaults access as kind of, you know, some other kind of...
I see.
Like, well, yes, library, like if the SDK had its own settings, for example, like yes. it had some persistent state that's part of the SDK that it stores, and it wants to store them in your app's user defaults because it's running within your app.
Right, but if you happen to make, like, you know, Swift defaults as your library name, and it's really just a thin wrapper around user defaults without much other purpose, and I think they're saying you can't use this code for that.
Well, I mean, I'm not sure about that, but what they say is if your SDK was created primarily to wrap required reason APIs, not necessarily this API, user defaults, but, like, you can't use it as, like, API laundering. Like, essentially, you make an SDK and it's like, call through this SDK and we'll get a name of your API, any other required reason APIs. It's interesting. I mean, the first one that Casey read was the one that I was complaining about back before I realized this doesn't apply to Mac apps yet. Was that, hey, app groups, it's an Apple concept. Everyone uses it. It's having a shared user defaults among app groups is a huge use case. So finally, they addressed that. So that's great. The third party one, I really didn't expect them to do, but I guess it's been so long and they've gotten so much feedback that they realize a lot of people are in this situation and they use a third-party SDK. That SDK has some setting somewhere that it persists, and it's going to persist them in your app's user defaults, right? Because that's where else would it put them? It's, you know, so they have to allow that. And I think this bottom part is, I guess, preventing it from being an API laundering thing. Maybe it's like a third party SDK for just wrapping user defaults. I don't see why that would be banned, but reading this language, it makes it seem like it would be. It's like, well, right. it only exists. It's a library, a convenience library around user defaults. But what are you using it for? To read and write your own app's user defaults. Like, that's not laundering anything. You could have done that yourself. You're just using a library for it. That's why I think the part where it says created primarily to wrap required reason APIs, not specifically the user defaults API, but any of the other APIs that are on the list that you have to have reasons for. We're just listing the ones for user defaults because it was the most egregious one in the original list of APIs because everybody's app uses it. And it was so restrictive that you just couldn't do basic app things. So they're addressing that here.
Yeah. And when this first was announced, I believe early, like in the late summer, or early fall, when we did talk about it, and I believe I said the same point then, so I'll be quick this time, but we don't usually know like the level of trickery and scamminess that apps try to pull off to try to track people and do creepy stuff. And so whenever we see stuff like this from Apple, like some kind of weird new privacy or security requirement that it seems like it shouldn't be necessary or it seems like unnecessarily persnickety, generally the reason is this has been abused or is being abused for some kind of creepy thing. And we just don't necessarily know about it or can't quite figure out like how could this be abused. But so in this case, like I'm sure they added these things carefully and with their inscrutable numbers. Why are these numbered the way they are? I don't know. But whatever the reason is behind this obtuse requirement they're creating here, it is probably because it was actively being exploited in the wild. So, you know, every single word of this, like every little clause, every condition, every exclusion, I guarantee you it was because somebody was being tricky with this stuff.
Yep. The final reason for user defaults reads, declare this reason to access user defaults to read the such and such key to retrieve the managed app configuration set by MDM. Why do we care? We don't care about this. Hi, future market. We can just cut all this.
I put it there for a reason. Don't just assume there's no reason. These things are all here for a reason. This carefully curated list.
All right.
I mean, so to cut to the chase, this is an MDM thing, right? If you look at the reasons,
I already said hi, future Marco. We got to start. We got to reboot the whole thing.
No, we don't.
Can't go in the finished show. You got to introduce it as if it were real.
Right. Here we go. Well, I'm going to do it all over.
Gold to the bootleg people.
Yep. HP.fm/gift. Now's the time. All right, let me be a professional here. And then finally, declare this reason to access user defaults and read the blah, blah, blah key to retrieve the managed app configuration set by MDM, mobile device management, or to set the yada, yada, yada key to store feedback information to be queried over MDM as described in the Apple mobile device management protocol reference documentation.
Yeah, so these reasons, I mean, again, we're just focusing on user defaults. We'll put a link in the show notes to all the new reasons, but there are a ton of them. And it's been a while since we talked about this, but this just shows how thorough Apple has been in making sure that all the use cases that they got feedback about are addressed. So just plain old user defaults. There's the one thing that I thought of, which is just obvious, app groups, right? Then there's a third-party SDK thing, which we didn't even discuss last time. Then there's the MDM thing, which we definitely didn't discuss this time. But you can just see, you can say, oh, you look at that. Oh, I see how that could affect people. Oh, I see how that could, you know, how many people have their own apps that they distribute over MDM to their corporate devices that are owned by their company? And they're like, well, our thing doesn't work anymore because we access user defaults and we do it through the MDM thing. And no one who doesn't have an MDM distributed app is thinking of that. But so many apps out there do that. So this Apple took a long time to come up with this list, but it seems like they've addressed a lot of stuff. Now, I'm sure there's still stuff that they missed, but this is a much bigger expansion than I thought they would have. Again, look at the full list. This is just user defaults, but like I expected maybe they'd allow app groups, but they added much more above and beyond that. So I hope this is now at the level where, let's say, 98% of the apps fit within it. It's still, I don't think they've changed anything about the strictness of it. I think there's some kind of timeline of like, well, it'll be advisory for a while, but then eventually they'll require it. But Apple's usually pretty good about not coming up with a new set of requirements and making it mandatory on day one and just destroying their entire app ecosystem. They'll, you know, do it slowly and hopefully get to the point where everybody's on board. And again, crossing my fingers, this still does not apply to Mac apps. I hope it never does. Please, Apple, leave the Mac alone.
Wow. Also, real-time follow-up from who? Someone in the chat. I've already lost where it was. MTZ Federico pointed out that if you don't have an iPhone or other Apple device to use Find My, you can use Find Devices on iCloud.com. When you sign in, you might be asked to enter a verification code sent to a trusted device. If you lost your only trusted device or otherwise can't get the code, select the Find Devices button instead of entering a code. I don't really know what that means, and I don't have the ability to research it right this second, but apparently they have a plan for you if you are in that situation. And this does not seem to indicate that you need a backup code. So I'm not really sure what the situation is here, but it's apparently been at least considered.
Yeah, these are all things we never want to find out. And unlike restoring from your backups, you can't, it's not easy to safely rehearse this. Like, I wouldn't like, because if you rehearse it and you find a problem with your system, guess what? You just intentionally lock yourself out of your own Apple ID forever. So don't maybe test this to the limit. But I guess, you know, it's up to Apple to try to communicate this to people and say, here's what you need to do to be safe. Right now, it's not entirely clear.
Yep. All right. A lot of stuff happened today. Generally speaking, this is a little inside baseball, but generally speaking, the morning that we record ATP, I like to go somewhere else to work. You know, oftentimes it's, you know, the grocery store that I like, Wegmans, or maybe it'll be a library or something. And I'll sit there and I'll read through all the links and make sure and watch all the videos, make sure I know what the heck it is I'm going to talk about that night. And I typically do that, you know, from like eight in the morning until roughly lunchtime. And then at that point, I consider myself having done the research and job well done. Pat on the back for me. Well, all sorts of stuff broke today, and so I'm shooting from the hip a little bit at this point, but here we go. And let's start with what happened at something like 9 o'clock in the morning Eastern time. It was broken, I think, specifically to 9 to 5 Mac, or at least in part to 9 to 5 Mac. But 9 to 5 Mac wrote that Apple is pausing sales of the Apple Watch Series 9 and Apple Watch Ultra 2 in the United States due to a patent dispute. And there had been rumblings about this in the past. I don't think we ever talked about it on the show, but in short, there is a company whose name I don't have in front of me, but I believe begins with an M, that has patents on how to do blood oxygen detection, and they have claimed that Apple is infringing on those patents. And I guess it's going through the courts, and that's not going as quick as this company wants, so they appealed to some other organization, the International Trade Commission, there you go, that has said, okay, yeah, we agree with you, other companies. So we're going to tell Apple they have to pause sales of the devices that infringe on these patents, which is basically the Series 9 and Ultra 2. For now, as we sit here on Monday the 18th, they can still sell them through other retailers. So like Amazon and Best Buy, for example, they can still sell these devices, but it is possible that around Christmas time, they will also not be able to sell these devices. So it's a big mess, and I'm surprised it's gotten this far. So I don't even know what to make of this.
I mean, this is why we really haven't covered it on the show yet, as far as I am concerned, is like, there's weird patent claims against companies all the time. And most of the time they get, you know, they argue, they, you know, everyone, you know, makes a big scene and then they settle and then it goes nowhere and it's fine. Like, someone pays some money and the lawyers make most of it. And it's in, you know, like all use of patents, it's just a tax on everybody and it doesn't really protect anybody from anything. And the lawyers make out with all the money, the end. Congratulations, that's the U.S. patent system. So a lot of good there, the promoting innovation. Good job, everyone. anyway, so there's a – so normally these cases, you know, they breeze through the news and they don't go anywhere because they get settled out and you never hear about them again. So when this stuff started with Masimo as the company, when it started, you know, them making claims against the Apple Watch, which I think they've been making claims against the Apple Watch for years now, claims of patent infringement about some of the heart monitoring and other, you know, medical stuff in it. Again, we just thought, at least I just thought, well, it's going to fizzle out and get settled or something. Like, that's what's going to happen. And that's it. And so to have us be at the point now where Apple has announced that, like, as possibly as early as next week, they might have to stop selling their two flagship models of Apple Watch, leaving only the Apple Watch SE in the current lineup, that's substantially different news than we usually hear. Like, that's a big deal. I'm guessing it won't actually get that far, or if it does get that far, it will be a fairly brief shutdown of sales. Because you got to figure, like, Apple is pulling out all the stops to try to get this, you know, resolved in some way. But you also know that Apple is, you know, I don't think Apple is super willing to give on, you know, threats of patent litigation like this. Like, I don't think they're going to just say, all right, Massimo, here's a whole bunch of money. We're going to license your patents and give you whatever you want. Like, I don't see it ending that way necessarily. What's probably going to happen is they're going to try to get around it with some kind of technicality, and then there will be more lawsuits, and it'll prolong stuff, and it'll just kick the can down the road further. And that will probably, I mean, that kind of thing can be successful for years. So that's probably what's going to happen here. But in the meantime, if they actually go through with this, because all they said so far is basically that they think they'll have to go through with this. If they actually have to go through with this and actually have to stop selling most Apple Watches in the U.S. for a while, whatever that, you know, and it, look, it could be a week, or it could be a few weeks, or it could be a month, or it could be 6 months. Like, we don't know. I'm guessing if it happens at all, it's going to be very brief. It would surprise me if it was more than a week, but we'll see what happens. You know, stranger stuff has happened, I guess, in tech, but I don't think, like, I with this much pressure on everybody from all sides on this, I bet it won't last very long if it does happen. But it will kind of be interesting as a, you know, as tech enthusiasts and as a tech podcast, it will be interesting to see if it does happen, because this kind of thing pretty much never happens in our world. At least, like, it doesn't make it up to the level of being visible to consumers like this. So this could be interesting.
Yeah, so Apple released a statement about this, and you can see the glimmer of Apple's potential strategy, because you would think Apple's statement about this would be all about how, you know, usually Apple statements are, here's the thing we're doing. So first of all, this one's weird, because it says, here's a thing that we might have to do in the future if everything continues the way it's going, which is weird, right? You know, so they're like, but the very first sentence of the statement kind of hints at what they're going for. It says, this is from Apple's statement. First sentence, a presidential review period is in progress regarding an order from the International Trade Commission, blah, 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 right? So it starts by saying, hey, there's a thing that's under review by the president. And if nothing changes, and if their review period goes through and we have to do all this stuff, we're going to do these things, right? It's like, you know, what Apple says, Apple is preemptively taking steps to comply should the ruling stand, right? So what does that even mean? I mean, I guess you could, like, well, get ready to stop selling stuff. I guess there's something they need to do. But why issue a statement about, just so you guys know, there is a presidential review period, and unless things go our way, unless someone changes their mind, we're going to have to stop selling Apple Watches. Convenient for Apple, by the way, that they have to stop selling them essentially on December 24th and 25th. So they get all their holiday sales, but they don't really get any post-holiday sales. And of course, you know, Amazon and Best Buy and stuff can sell through their inventory or whatever. So the interpretation of the statement is basically Apple announcing to the world / president, saying, you wouldn't want us to stop selling Apple Watches, would you? Because it's kind of a popular product and we're kind of a popular company. And if you don't do something, Mr. President, we're going to have to stop selling Apple Watches. Doesn't that sound terrible for you? So just, we're putting out this public statement. I mean, everybody involved knows this, right? But Apple puts out a public statement that says to the world, and, you know, we're talking about it on this podcast, something that everyone involved in this, this, you know, issue, the review board, the two companies, everyone already knows that. But Apple is kind of putting it out in the world to put pressure on the president to you know, overturn this, or to, you know, whatever they have the ability to, this review period of saying, because either you let it stand or you, like, counteract it in some way. And I think Apple's hoping that the president will say, oh, don't stop Apple from selling the Apple Watch. They're a big, important company and they make a lot of money. I'm not quite sure how the system works. I don't pay too much attention to patent law. I'm not a lawyer. I hate patents with a passion. I'm not sure that gambit is going to work, especially because Apple put out this statement. If Apple wanted to do this, they should be working back channels, not running to the press, because that never helps. although in the case of politics,
you could assume they probably have tried that already.
Like, right. But this is like the last ditch thing of, like, saying, hey, world, we're going to have to stop selling Apple Watches for dumb patent reasons. And this kind of is related to yesterday's last episode, where we're saying that Apple is a U.S. company and they are subject to U.S. laws. And sometimes there are those laws that they don't like. like laws about handing things over to the government, or in this case, patent laws. Apple patents everything because as a big company, they have to. It's the system we have is you have to participate in it. You don't get to be the size of Apple if you don't patent everything under the sun. A lot of the times you're patenting all this bogus stuff is so you can use it as defensing as other people using their bogus patents against you. And this war of mutually assured destruction, which is totally pointless and stifles innovation, and the only people it makes happy are lawyers. It's terrible, but it is the system that we currently have. And Apple sure as hell participates in that system. It's kind of, you know, a bummer for Apple. In this case, it seems like they don't have enough patents to retaliate against Massimo, and Massimo's playing hardball and it's not being bought off at the price Apple thinks is reasonable. So it's a game of chicken now. It's like, do you people and government of the U.S. really want Apple to stop selling its two flagship Apple Watches indefinitely because of some company you've never heard of with some super dumb patent? You don't want that to happen, do you? And Apple is not currently lobbying for reforming patent law, and I'm not sure if they even would, because, again, Apple participates so much in the system that it's hard to know whether they like it or not. But they have to participate in the system. It would be great if they lobbied for, you know, reform on software patents and reform on patents in general, but that is an uphill battle with lots of forces going in the other direction. And it doesn't seem like Apple has much appetite for that. So here we are. They're just out there saying, I know we have a stupid system and we tried to settle our way out of this. Now we're making a last ditch sort of plea to anyone who can overturn this to say, how about just let's not do it in this case? I don't know how that's going to work. One thing I think is for pretty sure, Apple will not stop selling its flagship Apple Watches for very long. I mean, worst case scenario, Apple just buys the company. Like Apple can solve this problem with money. They just don't want to. Right? Yeah. They don't want whatever Massimo wants. They don't want to pay it. But believe me, Apple can pay it. Whatever the amount is, Apple can pay it and will eventually pay it if this goes on long enough. So Massimo is, you know, betting that they can just drag this out to get a little bit more money. But in the end, Apple's not going to spend a year not selling its two flagship Apple Watches. They're going to pay whatever it takes to make this go away eventually, but they're going to try everything else first. And this is one of those things.
Yeah. I mean, that's kind of that's the racket of patents. It's just extortion. I mean, that's again, promoting innovation with patents. What you're really doing is, you know, creating legal methods of extortion, and that's, again, it's one of the many reasons.
And it makes it so that only the richest companies can even participate, because it's impossible, right, as we've discussed in the past shows, it's impossible to make any technology product without infringing tons and tons of patents that you can't afford to license.
Right.
Like, that is not, you know, the purpose of the patents is supposed to be for whatever the quote is from the relevant law of, like, the encouragement of the whatever arts or whatever, and it does the exact opposite. It makes it so the only way that you as a small company can have a tech product is if you get lucky and hide. Right.
Yeah, pretty much.
Because and the big companies violate so many patents, but they also acquire tons of patents to retaliate against anyone. And then you have patent trolls who are like, we don't make anything, so you can't retaliate against us. And it's just it is the worst system. And here we have, hopefully this will motivate some patent reform or maybe give Apple an appetite for it. Because, again, Apple participates so heavily in the system that I can imagine within Apple, there are sections of the company that think, oh, patents are great. We just, you know, our patents are super important. Remember when Steve Jobs was up there with the iPhone? Oh, boy, have we patented it, right? They always sound great when you're on the side of, like, using your patents to beat down other people. It's not so great when it goes the other direction.
And
the
look at how well that worked for them. Like, it didn't even work that well for them.
No, it doesn't work. It'll never work. It's because everything is stupid and all the big companies acquire tons of these really dumb patents, and they make it, like, Apple licensed the OneClick patent. Do you remember that?
Mm-hmm.
Amazon had an Amazon, for kids who don't know, Apple, Amazon.com, the place that used to sell books online and now sells everything, patented the ability to buy something with a single click.
Yep.
Which, if that sounds dumb to you, welcome to patents. And I believe Apple licensed it for the iTunes store or whatever, right? Because that's the way it works. It's like, how many dumb patents do you have? How many patents? That's why patent cross-licensing agreements happen. Like, I think Apple did a big cross-licensing agreement with Microsoft. It's like, look, we have tons of dumb patents, and so do you. How about we just agree that I can use all your patents and you can use all of mine? So at least we can ignore each other.
Yes.
And just worry about the other people who are constantly suing us for patents and stuff. And we don't have time for an entire show about why patents are dumb. I'm sure people disagree with us. See many past episodes where this has been discussed, including a couple on my old Hypercritical podcast. Our position has not changed since then. And especially, I think the entire Apple ecosystem got a taste of it with the round that came through and swiped a bunch of developers we know.
Oh, that was
a couple
Nathan Myhrvold's
back.
Company. The really awesome guy, Nathan Myhrvold. Because he hid behind names like Lodsys, but we all know it's Nathan Myhrvold.
And what was his patent? It was like something about some stupid thing about audio playing or something.
Oh, that was a different one. That was something like home, or was something home audio, something like that. That was the EFF struck that one down, I think. No, Lodsys was. It was some kind of, I think it was an in-app purchase thing. I forget what the details were. Thank God it actually never hit me, but it hit a bunch of people close to me, like a whole bunch
and
of people.
And the small developers like had to pay for it. And it really is like extortion, because they come to you and they say, look, we can destroy your company with this. So pay us all the money you can afford to pay us, because they want to get money. They don't want to destroy the company, because they destroy a company to get nothing. So they basically say, how much can you afford to pay us? Like, how much money do you have in your wallet? Just give us all of that. Right. And so for smaller developers who don't have a lot of their money, they'll say, OK, well, just tell us how much is in your bank account and we won't charge you any more than that. That's the shakedown of these things. Like, for the big company, obviously, they can't do it with Apple because Apple has billions of dollars. They're not going to get all of that. Right. But for the small developers, it's not like there's a flat fee, like everyone has to pay $2 million. No, because they know no small developers can pay that. But if you're a small individual developer, they still want your money. So like, can you pay us $30,000? You know, and people would do it just to make, but you can't afford to fight
right.
it, right?
Because the alternative is like, all right, then you can try to hire a lawyer for $100,000. Like, that's again, it's extortion. It's just the mob, but legal. Like, it's exactly like, you know, hey, it'd be a shame if that building burned down. You pay us for protection money. It's that. Uh-huh. It's just that, but legal. Like, that's why, I mean, the patent, it's so, now we're getting all mad, but like, that, it is so dysfunctional and proud. It's one of those wonderful stories that we tell people. Oh, yeah, well, you can be an individual inventor in your garage and come up with a great $1 million idea and patent it. And the reality is so far from that. Like, that is not how it works at all. Like, the only people who have patents are fools and assholes. That's it. Because to get a patent, if you are an individual, to get a patent that is actually, like, properly written, properly filed, and has any chance of at all maybe being enforceable, it costs tens of thousands of dollars just to file a patent like that. So how many individual inventors in their garage are going to have tens of thousands of dollars to pay a lawyer and file everything and get it all written up and get it done? And then once you actually – if you actually get that patent granted to you, that doesn't prevent everyone from using it. That just gives you a tool that you can use to sue people who use it. Guess what? That takes more money. So the only people who can actually get a patent and then afford to try to enforce it against somebody are people with tons of money already. And chances are it won't really stop a big company from stealing the idea and using it, because big companies, guess what? They have more money and more lawyers and more time than you. So, and I know this is kind of making the case for Massimo, but that's the reality. So, like, if you are a small inventor and you think a patent is going to protect you, it won't. It just will cost you tons of money. And then at the end of the day, it still won't protect you. So that's the fool side of it. And then there's the asshole side of it. It's people who you know, actually intend to, you know, deploy this thing against unsuspecting people. Because here's the thing, like, patents are allegedly required to be novel and to be not some kind of solution that a layperson would have just kind of come up with on their own in the field. So this is the argument against many software patents, is like, many people end up allegedly violating patents accidentally because the thing that is patented just became kind of common sense to anybody who was in that field. Like, so if you're writing an app and you have a certain problem you're trying to solve with some algorithm or some technique, you might just come up with that on your own. And the reality is that's how most invention works, and simultaneous invention is a real thing, kind of destroys the whole myth the patent system is based on. But anyway, setting all that aside for the moment, most patent infringement in most of tech is done accidentally and unknowingly, because so much has been patented by people who are just opportunistic thieves and vultures who want to be parasites on the world and want to shake people down for money because they think, well, I'm going to stake out my claim and get these patents and these things, and then everyone has to pay me when they do them. You know, people like Nathan Myhrvold. That's how he made most of his money after Microsoft. Nathan Myhrvold is a patent troll, and his company, Intellectual Ventures, is the biggest patent troll in the world, as far as I know. Anyway, this, you know, there are many ways to go through this life, and I try very, very hard to be the total opposite of that kind of asshole. And I hope most of you out there make the same choice. Anyway, so the patent system doesn't work the way anyone thinks it does. The only people who benefit are lawyers and giant companies. And here's a patent fight that is, you know, between two giant companies who, you know, are both trying to extract as much money out of the other as possible. Apple is, you know, and these views that I hold on patents and that John holds on patents are not super rare views in the tech business, especially. Most of the tech business doesn't like patents. And so there is no way that Apple is going to be amenable to any solution that requires them to pay Massimo for every Apple Watch they make, which is probably what Massimo is asking them to do, and probably a lot, because Apple doesn't want to be stuck with that forever. Patents last a very long time. I believe it's something like 20 or 30 years, depending on whatever it's in. Patents last a long time. So Apple does not want to be paying this company for every single Apple Watch they make some dollar amount for an idea that Apple thinks they don't deserve to have exclusivity on. And so that's what this big fight is about. Apple is very, very principled. We know that. We saw how hard they fought against Epic, which maybe we'll get to that a little bit. But we saw like the principled stand they take about protecting what they believe is theirs in the App Store and the taxes they charge to developers in the App Store and the gatekeeper fees they charge. Like they feel so strongly that, you know, to a lot of times to Apple, you know, they're very opinionated company, a very principled company, and usually that is a very good thing for everyone, including us, the customer. But you know, with stuff like this, they're not going to just say, fine, we'll give you $5 per Apple Watch or whatever. They're not going to say that because they are probably so mad that this company even thinks they deserve $5 from each Apple Watch, because Apple probably thinks they invented this stuff, or this stuff is common sense, or it shouldn't have been patented, or whatever. Because, again, that's how patents work. They're all BS. So I don't see Apple like being necessarily willing to solve this problem with money if the solution with money involves, we'll give you $5 for every Apple Watch we sell for the next 15 years.
No, they would never do that. They would just buy the company at that point.
Maybe. But what does the company want them to pay? Like, because Apple probably hates this company, and they would rather probably bury this company in lawsuits for years than to actually buy them. Like, because
I'm saying buy the company jokingly, because they wouldn't actually sell, and Apple wouldn't offer to buy them. But what I'm saying is that money can solve this problem in many ways.
Oh,
and there's just no way.
But they won't.
There's no way they would sign up for that protection racket where they pay that. You know, if they licensed the patent, they would do it the way they license all their patents, which is like, we just want to be done with you. We never want to see you again. Kind of like what they did with ARM. Not that it's adversarial, but like getting the architecture license. Whatever that license is, it seems like they can now do what they want with ARM without worrying about that anymore. Same thing with the cross-license patent agreements. Like, they just want this to be over and go away. And for whatever reason, Massimo's playing hardball and they haven't agreed on a price. But I feel like they have to, because there's no way they're going to stop selling the Apple Watch, right? They're going to figure it out. I mean, not for a long time. I mean, maybe they'll do it for a week or a month or whatever to put political pressure on, but they're not going to forego an entire year worth of Apple Watch Ultra sales.
So, what do you think about patents, gentlemen?
Not a fan.
Not a big fan.
No.
All right. I think we have time to keep on keeping on. So let's talk about the next breaking piece of news from earlier today. Adobe is giving up on their $20 billion with a B-b-b-b dollar acquisition of Figma. The two of them have decided that there is no chance this is going to get through regulators in the UK and the US. So the heck with it. We're going to part ways. Oh, and apparently Adobe owes Figma $1 billion in termination fees. Whoopsie doopsies. I can't say this is terribly surprising to me. And I honestly don't know a whole bunch about either company, because I've never really used Adobe stuff and I've never had the occasion to use Figma.
You've never used Adobe stuff?
Not really. Not in any regularity. I never touched Photoshop with
how
any
about Acrobat back in your PC days?
Oh, okay, well, that's fair. I didn't think about that. Yeah, that's true. But anyways, yeah, so apparently they're breaking up, and $1 billion to Figma. You know, you may pass go and you may collect $1 billion.
It seems so weird that they had such a big breakup fee in what would always look like a risky thing, because Adobe, despite Casey not using it, is a pretty well-known company with a couple of products you might have heard of, like Photoshop. They are the big dog in the markets that they participate in. Adobe has gobbled up a bunch of its competitors in the past, either gobbled up or defeated or both its competitors, being the bigger and bigger dog. And Figma was the first company in a long time to start giving Adobe a run for its money. So Adobe trying to acquire them, you have to, you know, everyone involved has to know, boy, this might be tough to get past regulators, because in general, if a company like Adobe started out as, you know, being an important, you know, company in their market and just grew and grew and ate their competitors and grew and ate and defeated their competitors and grew and ate and defeated their competitors and then wants to buy some the one company that has challenged them in ages for $20 billion, you're going to look askance at that and say, this probably doesn't seem like it would make for a healthier market. And so they put a $1 billion breakup fee in there. And as Daniel Jalkin pointed out earlier today, like, if, I think Figma has like 1,000 employees. So that $1 billion breakup fee, in theory, you could give $1 million to every Figma employee, which of course is not what's going to happen, right? Because that's not how capitalism works. But like,
can you imagine though? That would be unreal. I know it will never happen. I'm not arguing it will never happen. But can you imagine if any one of these, what did you say, 1,000 people, rank and file employees?
Yeah.
Can you imagine if just you know, they snap their fingers Thanos style, but then all of a sudden everyone's a millionaire? That would be unreal. What a cool story that would be. Unfortunately,
well, I mean, I think they all stood to make a lot more in their Adobe stock or whatever they're going to get as part of the deal. So this is but you know, obviously, all this money is going to go. It's, a few people are going to make a lot of money with this breakup fee, and most of the employees are going to make nothing, I would assume, because that's the way capitalism works. But yeah, that's a big breakup fee for a deal that if you had to place odds on, it would be difficult to know which side to bet. I'm glad they went against, not knowing the details, but my general inclination is competition is good, and the market that Adobe's in needs more competition, not less. And I have used Adobe and I have used Figma, and I do see how they compete with each other. They also are slightly complementary because they come at things in a different way, and the places where Adobe is strong is not where Figma is strong. But the whole point is people were using Figma instead of the equivalent or, you know, non-equivalent, non-existing Adobe tools. And that's why the market was shifting a little bit. It was like, hey, Figma has something that Adobe doesn't. It's a competition. They weren't making a Photoshop replacement that was better than Photoshop. They were coming at it from a different angle, really focusing on collaboration and focusing on the use cases that for the modern world that were, you know, lots of Adobe products were created before the web existed. So that really colors their lineage and their feature set. And Figma is totally focused on a, you know, world where we're all connected and collaborating on things. So, yeah, my instinctual inclination when any of these huge mergers come is let's not do that. Let's just let them go on their own. And Figma is not, I think Figma can exist on its own. People are like, well, who's going to buy Figma now? I don't like the idea that the only reason a company exists is to get bought by a larger company. I know that's a big thing, and there's some hemming and hawing about this. Like, oh, if they don't let this deal come through, how are startups going to get funded? Because the only way startups get funded is they assume they'll eventually get bought by the bigger company. It's like, that's not healthy. If the whole purpose of making a startup is to be eventually be acquired by the bigger company, all you do is feeding people and ideas into the bigger company that just keeps getting bigger and bigger. You can actually make a competing company that makes a profit and pays employees and makes a product and improves it. Like, lots of the companies that are around today started that way. Right? If they weren't, like, every single company that we talk about on the show would all be owned by IBM or something, and there'd just be one company that's called IBM, and it owns the former Microsoft, and it owns the former Apple, and it owns the former Atari, and it owns the former everybody because they just buy everything. Like,
hey, what's wrong with that?
I feel like that's the current environment, which is
really,
like,
great products.
Yeah. Which is like the whatever the big companies are that exist now, it's like, well, no other companies can exist except for these ones. And from now on, the only thing you can do is make a startup that you hope will be acquired by one of them. I think the last big one that appeared, I would assume we would say like Facebook and Google were the last two big ones to appear. And now it's like, this is it. This is the set. And your company is just going to get acquired by this, these stupid you know, abbreviations they have for it. I forget what it is, like FAMP or whatever. It was like, you know, Amazon, Apple, Google, Microsoft, you know, Adobe, like, just like, there's just these big companies in each of their markets that are so dominant, they stop them from buying everybody, right? And if Figma can't make it on its own, it's like, oh, where we invested so much money, the only reason we've been able to make this good product is because we're not viable as a standalone business. Our only purpose is to be acquired. Well, that's a bad business plan. Don't do that. Right? Being acquired, fine. Maybe that can happen. That's a fine way to exit for certain companies. But if you grow to the size of Figma, where the biggest company wants to buy you for $20 billion, you probably have a viable business on your own. At least I hope you do. You've got 1,000 employees. Someone wants to buy you for $20 billion. You can't make money. You can't figure out how to be a profitable standalone company. You have to be acquired. Or is it because your investors are like, well, the only way we get our big payday is if you get acquired? Ugh, it's more distasteful side effects of our economic system. So I don't, again, I'm not being gleeful saying, oh, because they get these Figma employees, you know, they're working within the system we have. And part of the system we have is one of the big payoffs you might get from working at this company is you might get acquired and you might make out like a bandit, right? And I don't begrudge them that. I think they deserve that as much as anyone deserves anything, but it's another example of working within a system that I think is bad. And we all have to work within it because it's a system that we have, but I really wish we would work to change that system. And part of the system, like it or not, are regulators that sometimes say that a big company can't buy some other company. And in this case, it was the UK and the EU instead of the US. But, you know, that's also part of the system. It's also part of the risk of being an employee and hoping you're going to get bought out by a bigger company. That merger may be stopped by regulators. And in this case, I'm not sad that it was stopped.
All right. And then the last piece of breaking news from earlier today is that data from test flight servers from 2012 to 2015. So this is before Apple certainly took ownership. I think it was before Apple even said they were going to buy test flight or but it was before all that happened, I believe.
Yeah. Test flight used to be a separate company, like a little startup. Mm-hmm. It was much more limited and much harder to use, but it was pretty useful at the time.
Yeah, definitely. Very well put. Anyways, there's a bunch of data that maybe has been leaked. I'm not sure that leak is really the right classification here. Maybe uncovered. We'll bicker about that in a second. Uncover might be a better word for it. Thank you. But anyways, a bunch of data, like terabytes worth of data has been exposed or uncovered, like Marco had said, from test flight servers back in the 2012 to 2015 era. And so we're not entirely sure how this came to be. We're not even entirely sure if this was recent, but certainly it's become a bit of a brouhaha over the last 24 hours. A lot of old builds, a lot of old data coming to light. It appears that this may relate to Amazon S3 buckets that were not properly protected. Maybe.
That's the fourth hard problem in computer science is properly protecting S3 buckets, right?
Right.
I think the deal with this, again, this story just broke this morning. I think the deal with this is that this data dump has existed for like a decade and people are just rediscovering it because people have short memories. And it's like it's in archive.org, right? Regardless of when this leaked, how old the leak it is, how much we forgot about it and are rediscovering it 10 years later because we all have short memories, it's not great. It's out there, right? Yeah. It's not the source code for these things. It's binary. So what you upload to TestFlight is a build of your app that you're testing on people's devices. It's not the final one probably that you're going to send to the App Store. Maybe, you know, it might be if they decide that build works, but it's all the in-between builds that you send. And so they're binaries, or maybe in some cases, bitcode if Apple Watch was around back then, for tons of stuff. And people are sort of digging through this giant archive of binaries, trying to see if there's anything useful. The link we'll put in the show notes is from Eurogamer. It's because it's like, look at these prototypes of games that never shipped because, you know, they developed them. They put them out on test flight. They decided they're never going to ship them. So if you want to find some weird unreleased game, including some unreleased Flappy Bird variant, because that's what people at Eurogamer are excited about, I guess, you could dig through this. But this is the difficulty of, leaving stuff unprotected on the internet. And then when it makes its way into archive.org, apparently it's hard to get rid of it, even 10 years later, if this really is a leak from people say it's not a leak. It was they just crawled it. But either way, TestFlight didn't intend for this to be in archive.org. And yet it is in archive.org because archive.org crawled the TestFlight site and followed links and eventually found all this stuff and slurped it all up. And now it's there. It would be great if Apple/TestFlight could say, hey, archive.org, can you remove all that? Because we don't own all that intellectual property and neither do you. So it probably shouldn't be in archive.org because it's builds of. Did you use TestFlight in that year range? Did you upload an app? Your app is probably in this data dump, right? And you probably don't want it there. I mean, maybe it's irrelevant. Maybe you don't care. Maybe it's a build of an app that's long dead or it's useless to everybody because it only runs on old OSs or whatever. It's weird, but it's also a cautionary tale. Check your S3 bucket permissions. And this sounds dumb, but like if you like Amazon doesn't make this that easy and they've worked on it over the years to try to make it more obvious when you screw this up. There are whole companies that part of their product is that they will go over your stuff in AWS and make sure you haven't done something boneheaded. And yet it happens all the time. Someone has an S3 bucket, which for people to know, it's just a place on the internet where you can store files. There's lots of imitators. And they accidentally make it accessible to everybody. And it's like, how would they not notice this? You don't notice it because you can't really get anything out of it. unless you sort of know the file name. So it's security through obscurity, especially if they don't allow it, like essentially directory listing to use web parlance. Like you can't, you can set the permission. So, oh, nobody can iterate over the contents. You can't list what's here. But if you know the file name, you can make a request for it and you'll get it, right? And the file names are really big and obscure. And it's like, well, you know, you wouldn't notice that it's publicly accessible because no one would be making those requests. But if you have a crawler, and especially if that crawler is seeded with like, it knows that you use like the app ID as the file name and it has a bunch of app IDs from elsewhere, then the crawler can just go through and try all those app IDs. The whole point is your S3 bucket shouldn't be publicly accessible. It shouldn't, random person on the internet should not be able to pull a file from it if it's not supposed to be publicly accessible. There should be some authentication where you have to be allowed to get that file, like because you're the developer of the file and that's how you can get it. But doing that can be a little bit annoying. And especially with the efficiencies of S3, where you really don't want them to go through your server or to bounce off your server. You want them to go directly to S3 because that's one of the wonderful things about S3 is that it's available everywhere and it's close by and blah, blah, blah. People take a shortcut and they say, well, no one's going to guess this URL anyway. We'll just make the bucket publicly accessible. Or they accidentally make it publicly accessible, but again, they never realize it's publicly accessible because it seems like you can't get anything from it without knowing how to get to it. But especially automated computer crawlers, they'll just follow links. They don't know which ones they're quote-unquote supposed to or not supposed to follow. So if they find an in, they'll just go and crawl and scrape and pull everything out of there, and it ends up in archive.org.
I mean, in all fairness, if you set up a new S3 bucket today, they make you jump through many hoops to make it publicly accessible. Like they've Amazon has learned, like, wow, people mess us up a lot. You know, so they like you have to. It is now so complicated and convoluted to make any part of an S3 bucket publicly accessible. So,
but people are motivated to do it because like my app's not working. I keep getting an error on S3, and they're like, they just bash AWS until the error stops. Like, oh, done. Now the error's done. I'm not sure what I did, but now I'm not getting any more errors pulling from S3. So I guess everything's fine. And then, you know, fast forward 10 years and someone has scraped everything out of their bucket and it's an archive.org.
Fun. All right. Hello, future Marco. How do we want to proceed? Because on one side,
I think we should go to Ask ATP.
That's what I was going to say. I know it's a little bit on the shorter side, but I want to leave stuff for next week.
We got a holiday recording schedule. So, you know, people listen at weird times in the holidays and we record at weird times in the holidays.
All right. So we're going to go to Ask ATP. Goodbye, future Marco.
Bye.
All right, let's do some Ask ATP. And Tom Bullock writes, what's the best way in 2023 to run an old version of OS X, for example, Tiger? I don't know, to be honest with you. I know that Apple has a bit of sample code, and I think Guy Rambo might have put something together where you can like use whatever the hypervisor is.
Yeah, virtualization framework.
Yeah, yeah. And you can very, very cheaply and reasonably easily create and run a virtual machine. I dabbled with this briefly like 6 months or a year ago, and it was pretty good. I would assume that the right answer is something like VMware Fusion or Parallels, but I honestly don't know. I think, John, you might be the best person to answer this question.
Best is the trickiest part here.
Yeah, best for
what? What is the best way in 2023? Well, getting back to our discussion about Palm devices, the best way is to use an old Mac. Because that will give you the authentic experience of what it was really like. For that definition, if that's your definition of best, that's going to be the best. You need like a CRT, you need a blue and white G3, you know, you need that's one definition of best. But I'm assuming that's not what this person wants to know. People want to run it without getting an old computer or dealing with all that hassle. Here's the problem, though. All of the virtualization stuff that Apple offers so far doesn't let you sign into an Apple ID, which maybe back in Tiger isn't that big of a deal, but as the versions advance, not being able to sign into an Apple ID what really cramps your ability to do stuff with it. Like if you're there because I want to try out all the old apps and see how they work, and it's like, oh, I can't do this because I have to sign into an Apple ID, or I can't use this sync thing or whatever. If you don't care about that, then yeah, any virtualization thing will work there. The reason people have made these virtualization apps is because Apple has a framework for virtualization. And if you can put a fairly thin app wrapper around that, the framework does all the virtualization stuff. You just have to deal with like making a nice UI and having people set things up and install or whatever, right? So that's why you see a lot of these hanging around. VMware, I think, still uses its own virtualization framework from way back in the day. That will probably be more straightforward and more supported. even with VMware, there are limitations. I have VMware and I have old versions of Mac OS X here hanging around for some old software and some curiosity. And it's not everything works. Like, if you expect it to be just like if you had pulled out that old Mac, it's not going to be. I'm not sure if it has the same Apple IDMA limitations, but definitely the graphics acceleration, especially on old versions, super jank. It either doesn't exist at all, or it exists, but it doesn't work the way you expect it to, or it seems slow. And if you, like, sometimes they all look like they're in safe mode, where there's, like, no transparency and everything's really slow, and you have to figure out how to enable the GPU acceleration. It's not straightforward. So the reason I mentioned the hardware thing is that really is the best. You'll get as much as you can possibly get. And even then, referencing what Marco was talking about last episode, there may be issues with TLS and SSL versions, which mean that you can't use the web browsers. You won't be able to really use it like it was back in the day because the world has moved on. But the closest you can get is with hardware. Everything else is going to be in compromise. So it really depends on what specifically you want to do. If you just want to run some specific app and it doesn't need your Apple ID, and doesn't need to do any weird networking that's not going to work because of TLS upgrades, then yeah, any VM solution will work. I liked VMware. I still use it. I think they're going to a subscription model soon. So if you want to get the last sort of licensed version that you can buy and use until it breaks, run and get a VMware Fusion now. Or otherwise, look at all of the various virtualization projects, but realize you're always going to be taking some kind of hit in functionality, which is a shame. Until, fast forward a decade or two, kind of like we run classic Mac OS, you'll be able to run Tiger in like a web browser using some JavaScript thing, right? But we're not there yet.
Also, I mean, do the virtualization apps, to the best of my knowledge, none of them will provide architecture emulation, right? So like the idea is like, you know, for an old enough version of Mac OS, if you are, say, you know, running on a Apple Silicon MacBook Pro or whatever, you're not going to be able to run something that could only run on Intel or PowerPC. So you're going to need something that can emulate those processors, and in addition to virtualization of the underlying OS. And I don't.
Yeah, I was trying. I don't think VMware would do that for you.
Does anything do that on Apple Silicon? I don't think we have that yet. I could be wrong. But
yeah, I don't
know.
I mean,
solutions,
it's
including anything that uses Apple's virtualization framework, they don't virtualize x86 emulation on Apple Silicon Macs. So you can't run an Intel OS using Apple's virtualization framework on Apple Silicon.
Yeah. So VMware is, I guess I'm still stuck in the Intel world thinking, well, VMware will just run natively on your Intel thing. But if you don't have an Intel Mac, yeah. And the virtualization thing exists for Intel Macs. It's an ARM only thing, but that doesn't stop you. There's tons of, before Apple came up with their virtualization framework, There are free ones. What is the VirtualBox is another free one. There's one other free one I'm forgetting. VMware is just a fancy. Oh, there's Parallels, which is another commercial one. But like I said, all of those options have some. I've used all of them at one point or another on Intel Macs, and they all have weirdness about them. Every single one. There's no one of them that's going to be like running it on hardware.
Yeah, licensing is weird too. Like a lot of the old OSs, you legally aren't supposed to virtualize them or aren't allowed to virtualize them, or you have to like find some pirated installer or whatever.
Yeah,
that could be both a pain in the butt and not entirely legal if you need that for like some kind of compliance reason. So again, like old hardware, as John said, the only major downside of old hardware, besides like having to have this physical thing that you're running, which can be physically cumbersome. I wouldn't say it's expensive. It's not, because old PC hardware is very inexpensive because nobody wants it. But it can be a pain in the butt to like get stuff on and off of it. Like the advantage of virtualizing on your own computer is that usually the virtualization intermediate software will have some convenient ways to like share files back and forth between your computer and the emulated computer or whatever. When you're dealing with physical hardware, it becomes a lot more manual of a process. You have to do things like, maybe transfer stuff with USB drives and deal with, the realities of that situation and stuff like that. Networking can, as John said, networking can be tricky, especially if it involves any kind of modern security requirements, like browsing the web at all can be very difficult on old computers. So it is a bit of a pain in the butt to kind of integrate an old computer into your environment for whatever reason you need to be running it, but you kind of save a whole bunch of possible butt pains by not dealing with virtualization or emulation or anything like that. So you're kind of trading some butt pain for different butt pain.
Well, I mean, it's not like a classic Mac OS. It's like anything that can run Mac OS X has USB, right? And so thumb drives, that'll like the, you can, an HFS Plus thumb drive will work in anything you run Mac OS X, and it'll also run in any modern Mac. So it's way better than classic, where you're like, what the hell is this Apple Talk thing? And how do I deal with that? Right? Or like you have to install an extension to get TCP IP, and you know, you got to figure out how to,
or you have to figure out like floppy disk formats somehow. Like,
yeah.
Good luck.
Yeah. Get a USB floppy drive, plug it into your Mac, see how that works.
All right. Rankari Anand writes, I was looking at the current set of EVs, and they all seem very unappealing for one reason or another. So I decided to put together a list of my requirements. I will read these. This is a lot. And I don't think you should be surprised that you can't find anything that fits all of these. But anyway, the requirements are as follows. No full glass roof, a sunroof that can open, physical button HVAC controls while you're out. At this point, you might as well give up. Physical buttons for or lever for the gear selector, and no motorized controls for the gear selector. Not sure what that means, but I'll go with it. Physical button seat adjustment controls, radar adaptive cruise control, CarPlay, preferably have a speedometer in front of the driver, not in a center screen. And the center screen must not be safety critical. In other words, the car should be fully operational, even if the center screen dies. How is this the future? How is this the future that we have built ourselves?
First of all, this all sounds very reasonable in theory. But second of all, like, even if you just say, not even just EVs, what new cars satisfy this? Not that many of them, I don't think.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the new Golf R, for example, which I know is, I believe, no, it's the manual transmission that's dying. But anyways, the new Golf R doesn't meet all of these, if I'm not mistaken.
It's tough to find a car that would meet all these, you know, even not an EV, but especially an EV. The reason I put this in here is because, we'll get to his final question is, what requirements do you have for your next cars? You can have a list like this, but you've kind of got to sort it by priority and decide where you're going to accept, because you're never going to get all of them. Like, I'm pretty sure there are, if there's any car that satisfies all these, you don't want it, right? It's probably not a good car. It's probably a car that you, because you didn't list things like how many people fit in it. Yeah. Like, I feel like that is a bigger requirement. Do you need to fit six people or do you need two? There, like, if we say, okay, we got a car that fits this
for luggage.
Yeah. We got a car that fits this, but it has a driver's seat, a passenger seat, and no back seat of any kind. Does that work for you? Like, it's like, no, I've got five people in my family, right? That should probably be a higher priority than no full glass roof. I'm just saying. So you've got to prioritize. But the reason I think this is a fascinating question, there was a story we had that's probably buried in the show notes, maybe we'll come up again at some point, about how customer satisfaction with their new cars has been declining, mostly blaming infotainment. And we've talked about this in the past, how everyone who's making an electric vehicle feels the need to do stupid things that are appealing in the showroom, but that people hate once they get the car home. And I was hoping that would be like something that would only happen in the beginning of the age of EVs. Like, we've talked about, you know, how and why it was probably a good idea for Tesla to do these things in the beginning, because you want the car to seem cool and futury. But we're well past that now. EVs are not entirely mainstream, but the only things keeping them out of the mainstream is their price, right? They're not exotic and weird. I see EVs all the time. Most of them, the ones I see, are not Teslas. It is, so there's no reason that every single company that makes an EV needs to do this. But they do it. And I think the reason they do it is like, well, EVs aren't new, but this is our first EV. It's like, I don't care if it's your first EV. EVs have been out for, what, a decade or whatever. Like, they're very common now. I know you're super proud of your first EV, but think twice before you, for example, decide to make the door handles crappy. Every single EV company is doing that. We've got an EV. The door handles better be annoying and harder to use and break more often. Why? Because EV. And if you say anything about aerodynamics, I will hit you with my little cartoon hammer and say, no, that's not why you're doing this. Admit it. You can make flush door handles that are not stupid. but they don't. They make them all stupid. It's like, it's okay for Tesla to do that. Only Tesla's the only company that gets a buy to do that, because they were first and they had to be cool and computery, and that's their brand. That shouldn't be your brand, Volkswagen. Just make door handles that work. People just want to pull the handle and open the door, and they want it to happen every time, and it would be nice if it still worked when it was like an ice storm or something. Stop making them electronic. Stop making them stupid. Same thing goes for everything else inside the car with the HVAC controls. Oh, you want to adjust your side view mirrors? Have fun navigating the touchscreen. No, stop it. Removing stalks from the steering wheel? Stop all of that. but people who are making EVs are doing this. And it's kind of like the Apple Silicon things, like how many years does it take from conception to the shipping of things, like 7 years or whatever, right? The cars that we're seeing now, what I hope is that every one of these car companies has learned, A, no more piano black plastic, and B, stop putting everything on screens. But the problem is there's a countervailing force here, because the countervailing force is part of the reason that Tesla continues to do this. It's cheaper to put them on the screens. Mm-hmm. And so despite how much people hate them, it's basically like, look, if we all do this, if we all make our cars worse, what are they going to do? They're not going to go to a competitor. So let's all just do it. Let's all reap the savings. Let's just have one screen and no buttons. And it sucks for everybody. But if all cars are like this, we'll be fine. And it's not that all cars are like this, but EVs, among EVs, there is a lot of sameness. Outside of EVs, there are still a few companies that now are bragging in their press things, saying, if you'll notice, we have physical controls for HVAC, right? And that's a selling point to them. They're using it as a selling point. Can you imagine in our childhood saying, so you're telling me you have buttons to change the fan speed? That's great. Is that a bullet point in your brochure? Because every car has that. It's like, well, in the dark future, not every car will have that, and we'll make you use a touchscreen. And the other thing I'll throw in under the bus is, because, like, and Mercedes is doing stuff like that thing we complained about before. Oh, don't worry, we don't have touch controls. That would be that's not good. We need physical feedback. So what we have instead is, like, on the steering wheel, instead of having touch controls, because you'll swipe those accidentally and you'll activate stuff. No, our buttons, you press them and they physically move in. It's not even haptic. They physically move in and out. But what they do is they make a giant piano black plastic panel with six glyphs on it for six different functions. And when you press any one of those buttons, the entire panel moves in with a creak and a plastic creak and some tilt. Mm-hmm. And the entire panel moves out. Rather than making six individual buttons, it's essentially one big button with capacitive sensors to know where on the big giant button your finger was when you pressed it. And they think this is better than making six buttons. But
Land Rover did that on my Defender.
Everyone is doing it because it's cheaper to make one giant button with capacitive controls than to make six individual buttons. And it is so, so bad. So we all just have to hang in there and yell and scream as much about this as possible, and try to find the one car company that pick one of these things that's the most important to you. Like, my thing is, like, I don't think I can buy a car with stupid door handles, and I think physical HVAC, those are maybe my top two priorities. But you can only do what you can do. If in the end there's no car that has those two things, then I just have to buy what I have to buy. But we just have to make it through this terrible phase and come out the other side. Or we just need some brave car company to say, no, we're going to design the interior of our cars to be useful and not to be inexpensive and look, let's see, in the showroom. But we were in a dark, dark period for cars. And I thought we'd be out of it by now, right? I thought this is going to happen. The first few generations of EVs are going to be like this. People are going to snap out of it. They're not snapping out of it. Or if they have, we haven't seen the fruits of that labor yet. They're getting worse. Brand new cars, like Volvo's new line of cars. Here's our new EVs. We made EVs before. Like, we have Polestar and everything. We're experienced. We've done this before. This isn't even our first rodeo. Our new EV, no rear windscreen. Like, no rear window at all. We'll just put a camera there. No, Volvo, stop. What are you doing? Maybe that's the Polestar. I forget which one it is. No screen in front of you, just a center screen, like the Model 3. It's like, have we learned nothing? Where are you going? It's so terrible. So I feel for this person. I understand the frustration, but the pickings out there are so slim, and there are so many bad ideas, and I would have more confidence they would go away if they weren't all less expensive. That's the less expensive in your $80,000 car. We got to save the 5 cents. We can't have six individual buttons on your steering wheel.
I think that's one of the most profound and impactful changes that technology has seen in my lifetime. That we, you know, it used to be not that long ago, maybe, you know, 15 years ago, screens were very expensive, just in general. Any kind of screen technology, you know, growing up, screens were very expensive. That's why, like, you know, you'd have like early computers that plugged into your TV, because you know most people would have a TV, but you wouldn't necessarily have the money to buy, like, a separate computer monitor. So you'd plug everything into your TV or whatever. And then, you know, later on, you know, cars, for most of cars' existence, couldn't have like bitmap screens. They had, you know, dials and lights, and occasionally at the, you know, in like once you got into like, you know, the 80s and 90s and stuff, you could have like little LCD segment displays and stuff. But
you remember the Buick that had a little, I think it was a Buick that had a CRT in the dashboard. I think we talked about it before.
Yeah.
So like, someone did put a CRT in a car, in case you're wondering if that ever happened. It was a monochrome CRT, I believe, but it was there.
Yep.
Terrible. Super terrible.
Yeah. But so like, you know, screens were expensive. And so there was always so much effort put into trying to do whatever you could without a screen, like without having a screen. Like when, like even my first BMW that I got in like 2009 or 10 or whatever that was, that the screen that would have given me the navigation system was like a $5,000 option. So I didn't take it. So it just had like, you know, the little like LCD segment display on the radio, and that was it. And the reason it didn't have all these features was because screens were expensive. And only in like the last, again, like 15 years maybe, that has flipped over so that now screens cost nothing, relatively speaking. Like screens are so cheap now that, yes, a screen is still more expensive than a button, but a screen might actually be less expensive than 25 buttons and all of their associated wiring and all of their service over the course of the vehicle's warranty period. Like if one of those buttons flakes out, then they got to replace it. Like once you factor in the total cost of having all these buttons and stocks and everything that need to be like, you know, manufactured, assembled, installed, maintained, wired, you know, tested, all that stuff, it actually is now cheaper in a lot of cases to just put everything in software on the touchscreen. And the idea of that, to tell someone 15 years ago that it's cheaper for cars to have a giant screen, a giant color, high resolution touchscreen, like that's cheaper than having like 15 buttons. Yes, actually, in some cases, when you factor in certain things, yes, it actually is. But anyway, going back to the actual question, I would suggest, despite everything we just said, you can get used to a lot of things that you might not think. So, you know, things that are important about a car are things like can it fit my family? Can it fit the stuff we have to do? Can it fit in my garage or whatever? Like, it, you know, physical, like large physical characteristics of it are important. You know, is it physically capable of fitting in my life and handling the tasks that I want it to handle? Is it an EV or not? Is it fuel efficient or not? Like the big questions like that, those all matter a lot. Stuff like whether you have to move your seat with physical controls or things on a touchscreen, that matters a lot less. So what I would suggest is, you know, shift your priority list. You know, a lot of these are like nice to haves, but maybe not requirements. Because what you will find is that if you're willing to bend on a few of these kind of more superficial or less important things, like, you know, how often do you move your seat? If you move it every day, well, then how often you move it, or how you move it matters a lot. If you are mostly the only driver of your car and you don't move your seat that often, it matters a lot less. Whereas,
and
like,
by the way, with all this technology, speaking of moving your seats and stuff, memory seats, the feature has been around, what, since the late 70s,
oh my
early
God,
80s?
So good.
Still, car companies are stingy about doing that. And sometimes when they do it, they only have two positions because they can't store the extra 3 kilobytes of memory it takes to store. Like, it's insane. And if you know, you mentioned seat movement. If you move the seat, you're probably also moving the mirrors. If you get one of these EVs where to adjust the side view mirrors and the seat, you have to use the touchscreen, and it doesn't have seat memory, or it has enough seat memory for two people, but not three, and you have three people using the car. If every time you get in the car, you are swiping around on a touchscreen to adjust both your mirrors and the seat, you are going to be hating life, right? And so when I say prioritizing features, figure out, like, if I had to prioritize them, it would be like, what things do you do most often? And changing seats, you know, again, like Mark said, it may be something you never do or something you do almost every time you get in the car because it's a shared car, for example, among two or three people. So think more about turn signals, right? And less about the hood release.
Yeah.
Right? So yeah, like
stuff you use a lot.
Yeah. Turn signals, changing gears. Those are things you use a lot. I would weight them way more heavily. And door handles. Every time you get in the car, use door handles. Or maybe you don't. Maybe you have your phone in your pocket and the door automatically pops open. But like, you know, because that's, you know, things you can get used to. But think about the thing you're going to be doing every time. Because as annoying as it is to use the touchscreen to open the glove box on a Tesla, you're going to open the glove box way less often than you're going to signal turns unless you're a BMW driver.
Yeah, but also, you know, like to play a little bit of devil's advocate here, like, you know, some of these requirements are things that you could get used to if they weren't satisfied, and some of them you can't. So, for instance, if you really want a sunroof and the car doesn't have a sunroof, you're never going to get used to that. Whereas, like,
can confirm, because right, that's where I too. Am right now.
or if you don't want a sunroof and your head hits the headliner, it's always going to hit the headliner. Right. You're not going to shrink that fast.
Yeah, like if you want radar adaptive cruise control, and if your car doesn't have that, you're never going to get used to it not having it. Like you'll just always not have it. Whereas, like, you know, if you say you want physical HVAC control buttons, you could actually get used to the screen just fine. You know, it might not be as ideal, but like, so that's like a little bit of a squishy requirement. What I would suggest is actually, like, if you have the means and time, if there's an EV that you think you want or I might like, but it doesn't, but it fails one of those like preferential things like physical buttons for HVAC controls or something like that, like, I would suggest go test drive it, or even if you can, rent one for like a few days, because a lot of that stuff, you'd be surprised how quickly you get used to it, and it isn't a big deal. This is what Tesla people have been telling everyone else forever. Like, just try it. Like, rent one for a weekend or something. Like, try it, and you'll see a lot of the stuff you think is a big deal is not a big deal. Whereas a lot of the stuff that you might not have thought of might be a bigger deal than you think. Like, I hate most Tesla door handles. Like, as John was saying, like, the door handles on Teslas are really annoying. All of them. Every model Tesla has differently annoying door handles. Even the new Cybertruck, which we haven't talked about and probably won't. But, like, even the Cybertruck, they found another way to have annoying, stupid door handles. That is, if anything, Tesla's most innovative department might be the department that makes annoyingly bad door handles.
Well, it's really important for the Cybertruck to be aerodynamic, Marco. You don't understand.
Yeah, like, they just keep finding new creative ways to make bad, annoying door handles. But anyway, you know, that, like, to me, the door handles are worse on Teslas than the lack of certain physical controls. Like, because the lack of physical controls, like, a lot of that you just get used to within the first day or two of driving the car. And it just isn't as big of a deal as you think beforehand.
Yes, but no. So let's take an example. Aaron's XC90. That has the HVAC controls on the center screen. I am used to it. So you are correct, but it is objectively crappier not to have physical controls. You know what I mean? So it's not that you're wrong, because you do get used to it, but just because you're used to it doesn't mean it's superior. Not having a gauge cluster in a Model 3 is crappy. Like, I'm sorry, Tesla people, it's crappy. It's not an improvement. Oh, but you can see the 2 inches above your hood. But I don't care. It's worse.
You're totally right.
That. Actually, although on that front, a lot of the a recent trend with a couple of car makers has been to still have the instrument cluster in front of you, but to make it a very slim, low profile one. So you get you get the benefit of, oh, you have better visibility over the hood, but we've shrunk the thing down. And
didn't
Prius
do that 1,000 years ago?
I don't know.
The Prius also had the offset one, I believe. It had like Toyota used to say, oh, it's better for your eyes because they're focusing farther away. It's like, yeah, it's 6 inches farther
didn't
away.
Didn't the Civic do one of those too, like around 2004 or so?
I don't think so.
I can tell you for sure.
Civic has always had an instrument cluster, I believe.
I can tell you for sure the Mustang Mach-E does that. It has a very small display that's your gauge cluster that has the bare minimum of useful and usable information, but that's all you really need. And it's a little slimline display right where you expect it to be. And I was going to say it's perfect. That may be a bit dramatic, but it's really good. And then they have the hilariously large center touchscreen thing where you would expect it to be. But at least you have some amount of gauges in the center. Like, I know you can get used to it. And I heard you say, Marco, that, you know, you're on Team Casey for this gauge cluster thing. But like, to talk to the Tesla zealots, you can get used to the center screen. I'm not saying you can't get used to it. but it's objectively worse. It's just worse.
Yeah, the mirror adjustments is another example. I think of this every time I adjust it, because we do have shared cars in my family. Every time I adjust the side mirrors, they're powered, because we have the luxury of powered side mirrors, because they used to not be. You used to have to reach over and do them, and it was really annoying. Kids, ask your parents. but I adjust them without looking anywhere with my eyes except for at the mirrors. You can't do that with a touchscreen. You have to look at the touchscreen to navigate, and then maybe if you're lucky, you have swipe controls in your steering wheel to do the adjustments once you navigate it. But literally, because they're physical controls and they're always in the same place and I can feel them in the dark, I don't have to look at them at all. I can and do routinely adjust the mirrors without looking anywhere except for at the mirrors. That is a better experience than using a touchscreen. And I don't want them to save the $5 that it would take to save on all the wiring or whatever. I'd rather have those controls there. So when I saw like the latest Volvo coming out with nothing on the door panel, including no window up down switches, no mirror adjustment switches, like no Volvo. There should be something on that door. There's a reason people put controls on the door, because that's a convenient place for your left hand to be when you're adjusting the mirrors. And if I want to take those people and shake them. Like, there's no excuse to be doing this for a 2024 model to have a door card with literally nothing on it except for an electronic door release to get out. Bad.
Yeah. So I think you guys are broadly correct, though, that you need to have some amount of prioritization here. And I think that some things will be must-haves and some things are want-to-haves. And, you know, you're never going to get used to, as you had said, Marco, or maybe it was John, one of you said you're never going to get used to not having a sunroof. I can confirm, because that's where I am. But you can get used to having on-screen HVAC controls. They still suck, but you can get used to it. And eventually, you're going to have to compromise. That being said, I haven't driven my parents' Chevy, was it Bolt or Volt? I always get it wrong. Bolt, in a couple of months now. But I think it may actually meet all of these requirements. Now, the problem, though, is that most people who buy an EV want to look fancy and cool and hip. And a Chevy Bolt does not look fancy, nor cool, nor hip. But it is a stunningly good EV, given the price that it costs. Like, I'm grading on a curve here, I'll be the first to tell you. But it is stunningly good for what it is. And I think it might actually meet all of these requirements. For me, when we haven't bought cars since 2018, and I have no current plan to replace either of our cars. But for me, I absolutely will not buy a car without CarPlay. And basically everything else is malleable. I vastly prefer cars with a sunroof, but I bought one without, because all told, it was the best option I had. Like, I am a devout sunroof person. As much as John hates sunroofs, or sunroofs, whatever, I love them. It kills me that my car does not have a sunroof. But eventually, you're going to have to compromise. That's the way this works. And so for me, the only thing I can think of that I literally will not compromise on is CarPlay, with a close second probably being I really dislike front-wheel drive a lot, a lot, a lot. And so it would take a lot for me to get into a front-wheel drive car. I would probably cave on that if I absolutely had to, but it would take a lot. If I were to buy a car today, I would probably buy the Kia EV6 GT, preferably, which is very odd looking. I've heard very crummy things about Hyundai and Kia dealers, so I might hate that car if I were to buy it today, but that's probably what I would get. Or they just came out with, the Ioniq 5? No, Ioniq 6. There's a Hyundai version of the Kia EV6. I forget what it is. Or maybe there's something that was just announced.
The square lights everywhere. It looks like pixels.
Yes, but there was...
Honestly, I think
just
they look really cool.
They just announced a new one that's like a direct competitor to the EV6. And for the life of me, I can't remember what exactly it's called. But nonetheless, I would probably buy one of those because it seems to fit all of my preferences. Note, I did not say requirements. It seems to fit all my preferences the best. The chat room is saying the Ioniq 6. That's probably... No, the Ioniq 6 is ugly as sin. I don't know. It's something else. They have like an N line, I think they call it, which is like their hot rod version of their, maybe it is the Ioniq 5. I don't recall. It doesn't really matter. But anyways, I'd buy one of those. And again, you're just going to have to compromise. That's the way this works. You're going to have, or in some cases, spend like $250 million on, a Porsche Taycan or whatever.
That's what I was saying. About your seating situations, because maybe the only one that fits your requirements is $200,000 Porsche.
I mean, honestly, I'm pretty sure Tiff's I3 fits this requirement list perfectly.
Yeah, people don't know what their requirement lists are until they see the I3 and say, oh, I didn't have not but ugly on my list.
There you go. No, but Marco, you make a good point that if you want an EV that actually works reasonably well for regular people, you're probably going to want to look at, I know BMW and budget probably don't belong in the same sentence, but you're probably going to want to look at a budget EV like the i3, which was not exactly budget, but kind of in that spirit, or the Chevy Bolt or something along those lines, because they are not fancy or trendy or hip or cool or whatever, but they do cross off, or they do check all the check boxes. So what's more important to you, getting all of these things on your very long list or looking cool? And that's for you
to
decide.
Well, and not even just necessarily looking cool, but like when you think I want to buy an EV, what you typically think of is the big names in EV. So you think Tesla, you know, you think like the models that you've seen, either where the whole company is only an EV company like Tesla and Rivian or Lucid or whatever, or you think of like the car models that were launched as electric models, like, you know, conceptually from their makers, and all of those are electric. And when you look at either the, you know, the all electric kind of tech forward companies, or those like, you know, EV, like, you know, statement models from other companies, those tend to be the most aggressive in their, like, you know, efforts to be futuristic, to get away from a lot of the stuff that we're saying we actually tend to want. You know, because a lot of the clean minimal design, and that takes away all the buttons that we like. A lot of that is, like, you know, an effort to be futuristic and to be a statement. And so what will probably give you better luck is not only necessarily going with budget models, but going with models of cars that were not always electric. So from companies that have made gas cars forever, like, you know, get like the electric, you know, BMW 3 Series or whatever, like, you know, like the electric versions of cars that car makers are now like reluctantly making, being drag kicking, screaming into EVs. Those actually will probably give you more of your list if what you're looking for is basically an old style car, which is what this basically is. That will give you more of that than the like cool concept car from the tech company.
Yeah, Mercedes really screwed that up by not going the BMW route, but instead deciding to make an entire parallel line of cars for their EVs. BMW said, we're going to make a 5 Series, you can get an electric and not electric, right? Mercedes says, you can get S-Class, or we have this whole other line over here, the EQS. Not the same car. You want an E-Class, or do you want an EQE?
Not confusing
and let me tell you, the EQ line, the interiors of the cars is way dumber. the bad thing about BMW is, yes, it's true that the interiors will be similar between the electronic and regular, but the regular cars have gotten dumber too, so yeah, it's tough. But at least the door handle should be semi-normal. And by the way, I was just looking at a picture of the Ioniq 6, which I do think is the one you were thinking of, Casey. Stupid door handles, what a surprise.
Yes, it does.
No, the Ioniq 6 is ugly as sin.
It's a sedan. That's what you're talking about, four-door sedan, right?
No, it's not. I'm talking about
I know the EV6 is not really a sedan. It's a short, squat crossover with bad headroom. Great, love it.
Oh, and the one that Ioniq I said 6. Looks cool is the Ioniq 5.
Yeah, it's the Ioniq 5N.
I guess the one with the fake EV gear shifts. People are loving that. they basically make the EV engine go for no friggin' reason, and they interrupt power when you do the fake shifts. This is great. This is the car with I believe one fixed gear ratio, and when you hit the little flappy paddle, they were intentionally interrupt power to the electric engine to make you feel like you're shifting. People love it, apparently.
Compromise, John.
I'm guessing that lasts two model years and then discontinued.
Well, it'll last until everybody who remembers what that's imitating is dead.
No, it'll last got a while until everyone tries it and realizes, oh, actually, it's just better.
No, people try it and they love it. They love it because they're people who know what that is. You can do a convincing job of pretending to be an internal combustion engine when you have like all the torque all the time. You just interrupt it in ways that, you know, they make the sounds, they do all the things, and everybody who tries it, they're like, I thought this would be so dumb, but I'm having so much fun. But those people will eventually die, and then we'll be rid of this. But unfortunately, we are also those people, so we'll also be dead.
I'm not.
You are. You know what that's imitating. You know about gear shifts.
Well, I know it's imitating, but I ran away screaming from it once I found electric vehicles.
Yeah, but
better.
If you tried it, you'd be like, I admit this is fun. It's basically a video game. It's a dumb video game.
I will say one other thing, though, like, you know, in the trade-off between, you know, old-style controls in like, a car that was started out as a gas car and was later made electric versus a car that was, like, electric from the start or a company that made electric cars from the start, what you are losing by sticking with like the old classic car model from the old car company, even after it has become an EV, you don't usually get some of the really nice, interesting, like techie features of the pure EV companies. Like Tesla and Rivian, for all of their shortcomings, especially in not supporting CarPlay. But anyway, for all those shortcomings, like one of the, like I mentioned a few months back, I really missed dog mode when I had Teslas for a while, and then I had to get the Land Rover for my sand permit, and I really missed dog mode, which is a thing where you could like leave your car and tap two buttons on the screen, and it keeps the climate control running, so if you have to leave your dog in the car and go into a store, your dog doesn't freeze or overheat. And it shows on the screen, like, my dog is fine, here's the temperature, so nobody, like, breaks into your car to free your dog either. And this is a feature that I assumed would be on any EV, and it's just not. It's on almost none of them. Like, all the, like, and it's one of those things, and there's a whole bunch of those features where, yeah, it seems like kind of goofy stuff that, you know, usually Tesla will be the first ones to come up with a lot of this stuff, and it seems goofy, and it seems like, why would anybody ever use that? And then you use it, and you're like, oh, that's actually really nice. All cars should have this feature. and a lot of the, like, you know, the newer companies that are tech-focused and very, you know, EV, you know, native, like mostly Tesla and Rivian, they tend to have way nicer features like that and way more of them. And the old car companies that have, you know, more old-style approaches, you know, less integration, less software control over their own vehicles, less ability to run over-the-air updates because they're tying together a million different things from a million different providers and stuff like that. Like the older companies tend not to have many of those tech forward or clever new features. So it's a trade-off you're making. If you want to stick with the old style controls and physicality and everything, that's great, but you will be missing out on a lot of that new fun tech stuff that EVs do offer from the, you know, the overly minimalist companies.
All right, moving on. Josiah Katz writes, how's call sheet going? Well, breaking news as of today, doing really freaking great because our friends at Upgrade, spoiler alert, have awarded call sheet an upgrade-y, which I was very, very excited.
Oh, congratulations.
Well, thank you. Look at that timing. Perfect, right? I didn't even put this in the show notes. I think this was John that put the topic in there. But yeah, Jason had sent me a message saying in so many words, you really need to listen to the beginning of Upgrade, which I did with the family, actually. We all listened to it together for the very first time. And the kids were extremely excited, which was very cool. So yeah, that was very kind of them. So check out Upgrade this week. But no, call sheet's doing well. I'm very honored. I'm genuinely quite honored to have received an upgrade-y. And as Mike had said on the show, you know, there were other opportunities where if this was just, I'm going to give this to my friend, they could have done this before. But it seems like I genuinely earned this one, which I'm quite happy about. But it's been going well. Development has slowed a little bit because life has been getting quite busy, as it has for basically everyone in this time of year. But, you know, releases are still happening. In fact, just a couple hours ago, a release just finished a 1 week rollout earlier this evening. There's definitely a lot of stuff I want to do, which is in contrast to most of my other apps where there were things I wanted to do. But, you know, if I get to it, I get to it. If I don't, I don't. I have a laundry list of things that I desire to do. To call sheet. My first priority list, as I call it, is only one item, but let's see, there are 44 other items that I have noted as things I would like to do. Now, a lot of these, you know, some of these are small, some of these are investigations, but, you know, a lot of these are features. And I feel like for the most part, I think I've gotten most of the low-hanging fruit. There's a couple of exceptions there, but I've gotten most of the low-hanging fruit, so I'm pretty happy with that. And I feel like the app is in a pretty good spot. There's definitely ways I want to enhance and expand, but it's in a pretty good state. And with regard to money, it's done pretty well. I just tried to start seven sentences all at the same time. So if you look at how much time it took me to write call sheet, which was around about 6 months as a broad estimate, if this was the only income I had, I don't think I earned 6 months worth of income from it, if that makes sense. Like if I hadn't been doing call sheet and instead was like doing independent consulting at, you know, roughly independent consulting rates, I would have lost money. But it's in the ballpark now, which is really freaking great. And what's incredibly great is that in theory, I'll be getting another payment of a lot of this money. You know, hopefully a large portion of this money will come again next year. And that, my friends, is incredibly empowering and incredibly cool. So, you know, my hope is, as I continue to add features and fix bugs and so on and so forth, hopefully that will encourage people not to abandon their subscriptions. It will hopefully encourage people to go ahead and tell their friends about it. And hopefully their friends and family and whatnot will subscribe. And, you know, hopefully over time, this becomes another item in the, you know, financial quiver, if you will, which is really important to me, because as much as I am so lucky for what I do, and I'm so lucky that I'm able to put a roof over our heads and food on the table doing it, you know, it's still scary. You know, if Marco or John drop dead tomorrow, God help us and God help me, that would be a really big financial issue for me. I mean, leaving aside the fact that I'd be devastated that one of my, you know, dearest friends has had something happen, it would be a real financial problem. And so hopefully over time, you know, all three of us, and I think Marco has done a very good job of this, but he had a pretty big head start, but you know, we all diversify and have other means of income. And then, so now this has moved the needle on the family income, which is exactly what I had hoped and what I had dreamed would happen. So, if there's anything you two want to ask, I'm happy to entertain questions. But in short, it's been going really well, and I'm riding a real big high right now on account of the upgrade-y. So I'm in a good spot.
Yeah, that's awesome. First of all, the upgrade-y is a huge deal. That is awesome. Like that, you know, like I've been around long enough. I've had, you know, enough success in my app career for long enough that I've gotten a decent number of like awards from blogs and podcasts and everything. It matters every single time. It never stops feeling cool. It never stops being a huge honor. I absolutely love it. I'm secretly hoping that, like, you know, when I release my big rewrite, you know, in next year sometime, I'm hoping to get awards for that as well. Like that matters a lot, and it's always
you're not going to get an upgrade though.
Well, I have lifetime achievement.
Lifetime achievement awards. You were ineligible.
Yeah, I think I can get a Mac Stories award for the rewrite. I think I don't know. There's going to be a lot of competition. What I would really want is an ADA, but we'll see.
I hear that.
That's my white whale. I want an ADA
Don't you feel like the ADA has been devalued through no fault of the people who have awarded? Congratulations to all of them. But I feel like sometimes it's kind of like the Oscars. Sometimes you question the judgment of the Academy. You know what I mean?
I wouldn't say they've been devalued, but they have shifted over time with different priorities. And that's, first of all, I think that actually gives me a chance, because in the original definition of the ADAs, I stood no chance. Like, because I'm not that great of a designer.
All right. You just got to hope you're using whatever API Apple is promoting that year.
Yeah. But, you know, but I think, like, I'm leaning so heavily into Apple's new stuff, like with SF Symbols and Swift UI. Like, I think I have a better chance than ever. That might not be enough of a chance, but it's certainly a better chance than ever.
It's an honor just to be nominated.
Oh, it
genuinely is. It really
is. Yeah, it is. If you think, especially on iOS, how many iOS apps are released every year? It's worse than the Oscars. It's just like you get like a 1 in 2 million chance.
Yeah, but also like the kind of app that used to win ADAs doesn't really exist anymore. Like, nobody makes that kind of app anymore. So if they were trying to give out ADAs for just that style of app, they wouldn't have enough candidates every year. So that at least enough good ones. So, you know, it had to shift over time, and the app market is constantly shifting. But yeah, honestly, that is my white whale. I am going to keep trying until I win one, and it might never happen. But that, like, if I ever do, just know that will mean a tremendous amount to me. Like that will be like, that will make my year. That will make my decade. I want one so badly, but we'll see. I never think I have that great chances on eBay. It's not the. I could totally, but that's not. It's not the same, you know.
So we were just talking about people were selling Eddie Awards. You guys don't remember this, but back in the day when the magazine would sell the little stat, or maybe it's Macworld.
No, it was Macworld. I have one.
Yeah, The big statues with the person holding up the Mac SE over their head.
Which, by the way, that is the coolest award I've gotten, I think. Because I got
But anyway, like those are available on eBay now for going for a lot of money, apparently. So you may be able to get an ADA cube eventually when someone dies and their estate puts it up on eBay.
Yeah, but I don't want someone else's ADA cube on my desk. I want one that I was issued.
Well,
that
you take what you can get.
We'll see. If I get desperate enough, maybe, but no.
And like the old ones had batteries in them, right, to light up or whatever, so I wonder if that battery will still be good in 20 years.
I think that was actually user replaceable, and now we've come full circle, baby.
Yeah, wasn't there an iFixit Terran? Somebody actually did a battery replacement guide on those. I think half as a joke, but it was actually real. Anyway, so all this is to say, Casey, winning an upgrade is a huge deal, and that's awesome.
No, it really is. And, you know, for me, I don't know if you and I have ever met, Marco, but I have a wee bout of imposter syndrome. And so, yeah, I know, right? And so for me, I mean, all kidding aside, for me to have won an award for my work, and, you know, I absolutely had help on the app, but it's still my work. And that is a tremendous compliment. It's a tremendous honor. And it's a little bit of, It's a way for me to convince the nastier subconscious, the nastier subconscious part of my brain that when you really do try hard, you actually can make this work, you know. And even though I do believe that for the most part, as with everyone, but especially with me, a lot of times I feel like I'm faking it, and, you know, I'm going to be found out tomorrow that I'm a big dummy, and so on and so forth. And I mean, hell, listen to the first 2 years of this program, and I think my confidence, to the degree that it existed at all, was not what it is now. And so for me to have this tangible, to a degree, you know, evidence that when I try hard and I do something difficult, I can succeed. Like, that's a really incredible compliment and a really incredible feeling. And it really helps me feel better about doing the thing, you know, the job that I do. And so I'm extremely thankful for it. And yeah, I didn't put this topic in the show notes, but it was extremely fortuitous timing. So thank you, John.
Yeah, I'm not out here doing it for the awards. I do it for the money, and I get neither.
I'm sorry. Womp womp. Oh, that happy note. I think we might be done.
Thank you so much to our members who were the exclusive supporters of this episode. You can join us at atp.fm/join, and we will talk to you next week.
Do we have a post show? I don't even know. I didn't even look. Not really.
I don't know, man.
What was your Eddie Award for? Was it Overcast?
Instapaper. Yeah, Instapaper was early enough in the App Store that I got a whole bunch of awards for things that don't exist anymore.
Yeah, the different category. That's the other thing. Unlike the Oscars, the ADA categories have really changed from year to year, just depending on whatever Apple feels like doing.
Of course, yeah, because again, like, you know, the app market is so different. Like right now, like there, how many like indie developers are there that are like crafting pixel perfect UI today? Yeah. Like, there's not that many.
I mean,
there are still
ones out there. That's why it's so kind of fun when somebody wins and you're like, not only is that app show off the API Apple wants you to use and does all the things right, but it also is like pixel perfect and beautiful. They do exist. They're just more rare than they used to be.
Yeah, exactly. But the thing is, like, there are so few of them left that I like Apple probably doesn't have a lot to choose from for the ADAs each year.
That's why how many years went by with this? I think they did like no Mac apps got ADAs for a bunch of years.
Yeah, exactly. Because like how many awesome new Mac apps
right,
are being
that aren't web views?
Yeah, like it's not a huge number, unfortunately. And so I wonder too, like how, you know, there's always a question of like, you know, what they're going to try to promote with the ADAs. And like, you know, so this year, I'm sure anything good on Vision OS is going to be, you know, substantially looked at. it's always, you know, they talk about other stuff. Like there's always like, you know, diversity and inclusion metrics. There's like fun metrics. There's
the game categories they have. Do you see all the game categories this past year or whatever? No, that was like the App Store.
That was
the
best
of
the App Store, right? Which is different. Yeah.
But even those, like it's... I look at those awards and it's so, I can't figure out how Apple picks like game of the year, because it's not the same way that, for example, a gaming website would pick its game of the year. I feel like gaming websites are picking like which they think is the best game, and Apple is using something else. Not that the games that win aren't good games. They're all good games, right? There's a lot of good games out there, but like, why this game? I think it's like, I think Apple will pick, for example, I think one of the games, they'll pick like a game that is only made for iOS and is a good game over a game that is better, but it's not a great port for iOS. You know what I mean?
Well, of course, because that's what they're picking. They're not picking the best game in the entire games industry. They're picking the best game on their platforms.
Oh, I know, but they'll have a game on their platform that's a better game, and it was ported to iOS, but the port is only okay. But
right.
In the end, once you're into the game and playing the game is better, but this game was made exclusively for iOS and uses all of Apple's APIs and isn't available on other platforms, and it gets the award. It's the platform tax in their awards. It's kind of hard to take them seriously when it comes to games.
Well, but again, I think they're looking for different things too. Like, you know, like what you look for in a game for, you know, if you're like, you know, a gaming website that covers, you know, the major AAA games of the world, that's a very different audience with very different priorities and very different games than what succeeds on iPhones for people. Like it's so different. It's a radically different market, you know, and Apple has different incentives, of course, as well, you know, because they are like, you know, you don't usually get a whole bunch of like, you know, Game of the Year awards like from Nintendo or from Sony. In this case, Apple is the platform. So, of course, they're going to have not only different priorities, but different incentives. You know, so of course they're going to prefer games that are, you know, exclusive to them and show off their stuff really well and take advantage of any initiative they want to push. You know, the games that are in Apple Arcade or games that are like cross-platform that, you know, work on your Apple TV also or whatever. Like, of course they're going to push that stuff harder. That's the nature of them being the platform owner and also issuing awards.
That's it. I mean, we can call that an after show if you want. We can just go to titles.
All right. Titles it is. Let's see. What was Everything I Dreamed It Would Be?
I don't remember. A lot of these titles, even the ones I suggested, I don't know what the hell they were. I like Everything Is Stupid. I like That's Not Healthy. I like The Fourth Hard Problem in Computer Science.
I love Amp
or whatever. What was the, what's Fang? Fang with two A's?
F-A-A-N-G.
F-A-A-N-G. Facebook, Amazon, Apple,
Netflix, Google,
Netflix and Google,
Netflix,
yeah,
Google, yeah. Yep.
What a weird selection of companies. Like no Microsoft. Yeah. Like it just, it's weird, you know.
Yeah,
why is
Microsoft
Netflix
gets cut
in
out of that one? Like you know, Adobe's not in there because they're not thinking about subcategories. But once you go into the subcategory, Adobe is. They're the big, you know. There's no list. It's just them.
Yeah.
And Figma, I guess.
Let's see. A lot of patent anger, but I don't know if I want to have that be a title.
Yeah.
I suggested You Know What They Are. I don't know what that is.
Bad job remembering our...
I know, seriously.
It says it was 2 hours ago, so it must have been early in the show. Like I have zero recollection of what that title was about.
I like A Creak and Tilt. I would do A Creak and a Tilt, maybe? I don't know. Let's see.
Yeah, A Creak and a Tilt is good. That's
using
good.
It is wearing it out.
What was
that's
that?
That's pretty good, actually.
Is that about the touchscreen?
That's vinyl and OLED screens.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I think I like that one.
I feel like I like others more, but I can get behind that one pretty easily, though.
I think I'm laundering number one, using it number two.
Yeah, so wait. Using. It's my number one and your number two's.
Wait, okay, so API laundering and using it is wearing it out?
Yeah.
Okay. Using it is wearing it out has enough votes.
Yeah, you're right. All right, there we go.
So using it is wearing it out.
Mm-hmm.
All righty, going in the robots.
Your OLED screen will last longer if you do not turn it on.
Unlike batteries, which will not.
Yeah, I gotta come up with a better. Speaking of batteries, I gotta come up with a better system for like when the power goes out. I have to wander all around my house dealing with each UPS. It's just I don't know like the USB connecting thing to your Mac that it'll shut itself down, but I never trust that. I do it myself, you know what I mean? Because I'm always just afraid it'll be like review these terminal windows and then it won't shut it down or whatever. So just shut everything down the old-fashioned way. And
desktop
then I have
users,
just,
lol.
I have too many UPSs, and then when the power comes back on, I have to remember that, like, even if I don't want to turn these things back on, I have to activate that UPS because there's a router attached to it, right? And if you don't have that router on, nothing works in the house. And
Sounds like a lot of work. Why don't you just get laptops everywhere?
Yeah, right.
That doesn't. The laptops aren't going to help.
I don't need a UPS for my laptop.
Well, your laptop is just as useless when the power gets out because you have no internet.
No, my internet stuff is on backup power.
Yeah, but it doesn't matter. Like, I don't think that, see, well, I didn't get a chance to try this, but first of all, that we've touched this before, the Fios ONTs don't come with a backup battery anymore.
That's
but
also
second of all,
power.
Even if they did, I think when something like this happens, even if the ONT is still powered and has backup power, I don't think things downstream from the fiber optic that leaves my house are going to be turned off.
No,
I guess
I
it depends on how big the
they
power outage
were.
Is.
I am not confident I'm right, but I could.
But you
swear.
Don't have a battery in yours anymore, either, do you?
Not anymore. I did early on,
yeah,
but
none
I don't
of the
anymore.
New ones do. Yeah. No, but like it would like for me to lose internet connectivity, it has to either Verizon has to lose power on their end or the fiber line has to be cut.
Well, no, because the fiber line leaves your house and goes somewhere to some
yes.
box, and
I'm
that
saying,
if that
like,
box requires electricity, and if that box doesn't have it, then you know. So
yeah,
it depends
but
on how
that
big the
box
outage
is like on Verizon's end. Like all the stuff on my end is backed up,
including the ONT.
Of course,
that's true.
Yeah,
I guess
my laptops are plugged into the UPS too. It just sits on the desk. Like I have my like development MacBook Air over here. It's plugged into a power thing that's plugged into a UPS.
Nice.
All right. And they all make beeping noises, and then you.
Oh yeah, that's the worst.
Silence the alarm. I mean,
I don't know if you knew this. There are UPS models where you can turn off the beep.
No, you can turn it off on these too. But I do want it to be on to remind me to go deal with them. But it's just, you know. And I always have to like let me Google for how to make the Synology shut down because I can't connect to them. Right, I can't. Like,
oh no.
Right, but there is. I always forget what it is, but then I always just like, I'm like, well, whatever. And I just hold the power button. What you basically do, mm-hmm. At least on both of my Synologies, is you hold the power button for a few seconds until it makes a noise and you let go
and it
shuts itself down.
Yeah.
Yep.
Cleanly. So in case you're wondering, that's how that works.
We don't have time for this tonight, but man, my Synology is dying and I am not super keen to replace it. And I'm very mad that it's dying.
Is this your second Synology? Like you got?
Yeah, this is my little
right?
one. Well, no, my old one from Westchester is in a box somewhere, waiting for my house to be livable. But I don't even. I it's been powered off for like 4 or 5 months because I just was never there. But I don't necessarily think I'm gonna even use it anymore, like the big one, because it's so out of date now. It's so old. But,
yeah, the 1813s that we were originally given.
That I'm still using.
Yeah, I know. I don't know how, John, because I agree with Marco that my 1813, I'm currently using it as a footrest because I can't figure out a better thing to do with it.
That's a good use.
I should do something better with it. But
you should all send me all your hard drives. Because eventually mine will die and I'll just swap them on yours.
But
I'll swap in another 10-year-old hard drive.
Yeah, right? And they're all like, you know, 2 or 4 terabytes. Like they're not big hard drives.
No,
by any means.
Mine is enough of a ship.
Yeah,
thesis
Casey upgraded
that,
his.
Yeah, mine would be useful in that capacity. But what I think I was actually thinking about this just the other day. What I want to do is I want to put the 1813 somewhere in the house where it can serve as a like maybe not live, but a local replica of the Synology.
Where you need some extra noise. Where in your house do you need some extra noise?
That's the thing, is that I would just put this damn thing in the garage because I don't really care. And I have enough weather, despite what John thinks, that might not be a wise choice. But
I ran mine in the garage in Westchester for 10 years, and it was fine. It never had any problems.
It's filled with spiders now.
It's nothing but spider eggs. But the problem I have is I have no Ethernet situation anywhere near my garage.
Oh, we're going to revisit that too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know.
Once you do your fiber optic conversion.
Exactly. So next thing I know, just to get my Synology in the garage, I'm now rewiring the whole damn house or something like that. So yeah, I don't know what I'm going to do with it other than continue to use it as a footrest. So I need a better answer, but I don't know what that answer is. That's right. All right, let's go to bed. Good night, live people. We will be live again, Thursday? Is that right?
That is the current plan.
All right.
Yeah, so not Wednesday, but Thursday, yes.
All right. Goodbye, live people.
Right. Bye, live people.
Live.
Thanks for listening. Talk to you on Thursday.
And thank you, members, for making this episode happen.
Yes, very much.
That was very helpful. So thank you, members.
Cool. See you.